Welcome, everyone. Today's webcast is about to begin. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Good morning, everyone. This is Karen Pace here at NQF, and thank you for joining the call. We're going to start with a roll call of the expert panel just to make sure we know who's here. And I'm going to just note that we have a separate line for the expert panel. So if for some reason when we call your name and you're on, but you're not on a speaking line, please press star zero to get the operator's attention so that we get you into the right line. So Erin, will you do the roll call so we can see who's here?
Thanks, Karen, and I apologize in advance to anyone whose name I butcher. Kevin Siskella?
Yes.
David Nguyen?
Here.
Dean Asias? Dean Asias? Alice Adams?
Here.
Mary Barger?
Here.
Susanna Bernheim?
Here.
Monica Barrow?
Hello, Monica. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Mary Beth Callahan? Mary Beth Callahan? Lawrence Castellino?
Here.
Alina Tien? Alina Tien? Marshall Chin?
Here.
Mark Cohen?
Here.
Norbert Goldfield?
Here.
Nancy Garrett? Nancy Garrett?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Atul Grover? David Hopkins?
I'm here.
Okay. Dion Jimenez?
I'm here.
Stephen Lipstein?
Here.
Eugene Nuccio?
Here.
Sean O'Brien?
Here.
Pam Owens? Pam Owens, are you on the line? Nina Tan?
Here.
Sue Quach?
Here.
Tia Sani?
Here.
Nancy Sugg?
Here.
Rachel Warner?
Here.
Thank you, everyone.
Hi, this is Mary Beth Callahan. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good.
So I'll just do one last check. Jean Ashes, Alina Chin, and I think Atul Grover, and Pam Owen.
Atul sent a note this morning.
Okay. Thank you all for joining us. I'm going to do a quick process and agenda, and then we'll turn it over to Dave and Kevin for some opening remarks. So, you know, we scheduled this time for 4 hours, just in case, but hopefully we'll end before that. We will take a break at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, 10 minutes, just to give people a chance to get a little break in between. And we'll basically be working through the comment themes that we identified in the briefing memo. And try to work through some of those comments and discuss potential responses to them. So we'll get into that more as we go along, but for now I'm going to first turn over to Kevin and then Dave to make some opening remarks.
I want to thank everybody for blocking out their schedules for this three-hour meeting. I know it's not easy. We all have very busy lives, and I think as everybody has read, the report has has gleaned lots of responses from many different parties, and including some national press. And I think our task today is to really begin to synthesize those comments and with our collective wisdom come up with a balanced approach to those concerns. I don't think either Dave nor I have a preconceived idea as to how the results of this discussion will turn out. But as before, we want to give everybody a chance to voice their own perspective, and to and if you haven't already, bring any new data that hasn't been cited to the task.
So Kevin, this is Nancy. I heard you say it's a 3-hour meeting. I have 4 hours blocked off.
Yes, 4 hours. I'm sorry. Yes, you're
okay.
Correct. 4 hours.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's actually 4 hours. We're hoping we can end before 3, but we have 4 hours blocked off. Thank you for the clarification.
All right, we're ready to go. Thank you.
Okay, and Dave?
I just want to echo Kevin's thanks to everyone. Maybe a slightly different flavor. In looking back at the work we've done so far, I think we should all take pride in the discussions we've had, the ideas we've generated, the nature of the draft report that's been created. And I think what that reflects is not only a lot of really smart and good input, but also a very high level of mutual respect, collegiality, and openness to listening to this. You know, these are issues that can get heated sometimes. I think our discussions have been really excellent, the in-person, the prior conference calls, and I certainly have nothing but hope that we'll carry that forward as we go along. And as Kevin said, I think our charge at this point is to you know, make whatever enhancements or modifications to the report that we think we should based on the extensive comments that came in. Helen will tell us a little more about exactly how that process needs to work. But in looking at what we've done so far and what I think we can do by the time we get to the finish line, I'm very, very appreciative of all the time, the thought, the hard work that's gone into where we are now, and look forward to even more as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. I asked Helen Burstyn to we had put some things in the briefing memo about NQF process and addressing comments, but I asked Helen to share some things with us about NQF process. So, Helen.
Great. Thanks, everybody. First, I do want to also just extend my thanks to the entire committee, but also in particular to Dave and Kevin, who by far in my 7 years at NQF have been the hardest working chairs and most engaged I've ever worked with. So really, thank you. And also special thanks to Karen, obviously, for her amazing stewardship of this work. I will tell you, several very high prominent policy people have sent some comments to me that are along the lines of, you know, this is probably the most important issue in quality measurement, one of the most important debates in today's pay for performance. So there's no question this is a timely and really important piece of work. Just a few words about consensus. And I really do want to emphasize that as a consensus-based organization, our goal here is actually to find common ground, see if we can actually review these comments, find a place where we can actually find some resolution. Because I think this is not the kind of issue where I think we want to wind up having a deeply polarized membership. I think this is hopefully a place we can actually find that common ground through the 4 hours of our time together today. A little bit about consensus and what it means, and Karen included some of that in the memo for you, but the definition of consensus that we use as a standard-setting organization, as dictated by the OMB circular, is that it is general agreement, but not unanimity, and I think that's really important. But general agreement is also important. We don't want to wind up here having significant disagreements as a result of this. It goes on further to state that our goal here is to really be attempting to resolve objections by interested parties, and we need to fully consider each objection, each comment, And then tell everybody why and how those objections or concerns were addressed. With 670 comments, that is not an insignificant task, but obviously many of them fit into similar categories, and I think the number does a great job of laying out those ideas. But just in terms of next steps, while there are so many comments, 670, also a record for NQF, you know, overwhelmingly in terms of the numbers, they are overwhelmingly positive, but they are also overwhelmingly heavily from, you know, two stakeholders, providers in particular, and health professionals. But we need to consider the comments across the wide variety of stakeholders. And there were some consumers and purchasers who were positive, actually, three in particular, but there were also some that were negative. But as this report moves on to the next steps in our consensus process, to the CSAC and then to the NQF board, those are groups that are consumer and purchaser majority groups. So, again, I can't emphasize enough how important it is for us today to try to consider the comments, consider whether there are opportunities to, in fact, bring people together and see if we can find common ground, because we would very much like to have this report finalized and out there in early summer. I think a lot of people are looking to this and hoping that it will help really address what I think, you know, accurately described by many as being something that tends to be such an important block in our ability to do better in terms of performance measurement and disparities reduction. So with that, I will turn it back over to Dave and Kevin.
And this is Karen. I'm going to jump in here for just one second and just say that I think before we get into the specific comments and themes, that we wanted to give the each of the panel members the opportunity to make some brief comments about your general impressions or any specific issue that you think is, you know, really important for us to discuss today. And I'll start with Kevin and Dave there. So Kevin and Dave, if you want to start us out, and then I can go through the list so that I know it's hard. We're at a disadvantage because we can't see each other. Kevin, do you have anything you want to say in general, our general impressions about the comments or specific issues? Or?
Yeah, I don't really have too much to say. I think that I think you did a nice. I think the issues have been laid out, and some are issues of clarification and response in terms of evidence. Others relate to issues of essentially unforeseen or potentially unintended consequences of either not adjusting or adjusting, and thinking about potential mechanisms to monitor, for example, those unintended consequences. And some of that came up both in the public comments as well as comments in some of the in some of the webinars. So I think we need to think about both pieces.
Okay, thank you. Dave, Maren?
And I think just in broad framing, I think the agenda that we have in front of us in the memo is going to guide us through what I consider the main issues. You know, when you look at the spectrum of comments, it's reassuring, and you feel good when the vast number of them say, you've got it right, thank you for the work you've done. But we really have to focus on those that express concern or objection. Among those, it seemed like there are three themes that come up in essentially all of them, and they're themes actually we all had among ourselves when we started this process. If there is adjustment, does that have the effect of masking disparities? Does it have the effect of creating a lower standard of care for providers or plans that serve disadvantaged patients or plan members, and do you lower incentives? I think if I was asked for, you know, what's the main critical comment, it would be those three issues. But I think we have those teed up in front of us already in terms of the agenda, so I'm sure we'll speak to them.
Okay, thank you. Elise Adams, do you have any brief comments that you'd like to make to just start us out?
No, I completely agree about the comments that were just made about the fact that these are all issues that came up during our conversation, so certainly none of it's a complete surprise. I think it would be nice if we could come to a consensus where we were able to minimize both the risks associated with adjustment and the risks associated with not adjusting. I don't know if such a nice common ground exists, but I'd like to get there. And I guess that's it.
Okay, thank you. Mary Barger?
I don't have any additional things to add. I would just echo what Melissa just said.
Okay, thank you. Susanna Bernheim?
Hi, yeah. I think that from my perspective, the comments, particularly coming from the consumer and purchaser group, point to a need for us to help. I think if we can help to operationalize a little bit more the recommendations we have, which is not a simple task, it will help people sort of see how this might play out and that that's going to help people, because I think the recommendations are meant to carry a sense that there are times when you would want to risk adjust and times when you wouldn't. And I think the concerns from that group are that the report sounds more sort of totally pro-risk adjustment than I think the consensus in the committee is. So I think if we can help just clear and clarify better kind of how these decisions will be made, even if we can't explain it perfectly, people will feel like there's a path for measures to be individualized. And I think that will get us a long way towards responding to these comments.
Okay. Thank you. Monica Barrow?
I agree with everything that's been said, particularly this issue around we have such a nuanced discussion, and are there ways that we can enhance the report itself? I think a lot of us have consensus around the issues, but the way the report reads, maybe there needs to be some clarification, and I can make suggestions as we go around those nuances. And particularly for the comment, in general, the comments that came through, the concept of risk adjustment that we're already doing for many clinical issues, we've talked about this several times, such as something like diabetes, and how these current risk adjustments that we're talking about parallel the clinical ones. I think we can do some clarification there as well.
Okay, thank you. Mary Beth Callahan?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think that this is just excellent work, and I think that in the memo that went out ahead of time, some of the responses as potential clarification are very good, and I know we'll discuss those later. My greatest concern is, of course, the things I've seen in Texas happening with Medicaid managed care and the problems we've had for patients getting access to doctors because of what's happened with Medicaid managed care. So I'm kind of on the fence with all of this, but I think the report is very good.
All right, thank you. And Larry Castellino?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I thank you for the memo. I think it was extremely useful and helped me in reviewing the comments. I thought the comments were really good. I think that I'm talking about they were all good, but I'm talking about the critical ones now specifically. You know, they raised a lot of issues, but I hope that we'll be very careful not to kind of get caught up in relatively micro issues and be tired or not have enough time to deal with, I think, the biggest single criticism operationally, which is the idea of presenting one single number adjusted for SES. I think that's really the crux of what's going on. I hope we'll spend good time on that. I actually think there's there's a fairly simple way of responding to that that could satisfy everybody. That's it.
Thank you. And Marshall Chin?
I think when you look at recommendation one, how we've divided into, for purposes of accountability, risk adjusting by SES, and then the second bullet about for identifying induced disparities, having stratified measures. Then that was our attempt to basically have the fairness issue with risk adjustment, but also have an active component that aims at shining light on disparities and encouraging solutions. Look at the comments. People tend to focus on the first part of the recommendation, but not on the part you mentioned about identifying disparities and stratifying data. And part of that is that potentially we might need to have more in the report about sort of following that line of thought, so that people are concerned about, well, are we mapping disparities? Are we getting a pass for the disparities issue? Part of the response is clarifying how that second bullet, where that heads for reducing disparities. So that's overall, I mean, the current recommendation one tries to do both, but the second part about actually the disparity solution, perhaps we can work on how we make that argument clearer or that discussion clearer, and that may help with some of the, I guess, over-gestalt people, the critics have taken away from this of not addressing disparities.
Okay, thank you. Mark Cohen?
I have nothing to add right now.
Okay. Norbert Goldfield?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So I'll make two comments. Number one, to put it in a phone-appropriate manner, I was quite interested to see that the report hit the New York Times. And the headline, I believe, addressed head-on the issue that has always been the 800-pound gorilla, even though there's been some, you know, statements from time to time that, in fact, payment is not being addressed. In fact, you know, it's all about payment at the end of the day. And so I just want to highlight, as my first comment, that that looking at a historical perspective, PPS would never, never have been implemented in 1982 if there had not been a disproportionate share policy. So that's my first comment. My second comment is that I believe, as has already been stated, and I think the, in fact, we as researchers neither agree with the MedPAC approach, even though we do a lot of work with MedPAC, nor do we believe in necessarily a one-score approach. So we would suggest, and I would suggest, a letting a thousand flowers bloom, because there's a lot that we don't know, that we really, that SES must be addressed. But there are many different ways of doing it, and there's still a lot we don't know. And I certainly, for one, have been very appreciative of being on the panel.
Nancy Garrett?
Yeah, so I think, to me, one of the most interesting things about today is how do you take all of these comments? There's so many that we got. I mean, it sounds like it was kind of a world record for NQF in terms of the number of comments. And how do you balance what Helen was talking about the idea of consensus around the stakeholders, but make sure we're moving forward with, you know, the recommendation that our committee really feels we can stand behind. So that balancing and how to take into account the comments and have a, but still have a balanced perspective is going to be, I think it's going to be tricky. So we'll be looking to the NQF staff for guidance, I think, on how to do that. I'm a little bit worried about that we might take some of the comments not in support and give them more weight than they really should have, given that we had so many in support. So that'll be an interesting thing, I think, as we go forward.
Okay, thank you. David Hopkins?
Good morning, everyone. Well, as you know, I'm the one that represents the consumers and purchasers here. Not that we all don't in one way or another, but that's my specific role. And so it's been noted, we're the skeptics, not yet convinced, I think is the best way to portray it. Dave Nairns did a wonderful job a few minutes ago of summarizing very briefly the major concerns about unintended consequences. We were looking for more evidence of the kind that NQF usually employs in making its decisions for doing things one way or the other, still looking for that. I think that it's one of the things we could do today, and it's already been mentioned, I think, by Susanna, is to reach more specificity on the recommendation. So if it's appropriate to include SES in risk adjustment, can we get a little bit more specific about under what circumstances, for what kinds of measures, what SES factors, what data, and so on and so forth, to make it a lot more practical. Thirdly, I would hope that we could try to separate payment issues from measurement issues. Not an easy thing to do in this day and age, but I think our focus here is on getting the measurement right. And there are plenty of places where we can try to work on attainment. And I think we're all with you. I'm speaking to safety net providers here. We recognize your burden and the resources not being sufficient, and would be just as happy to get involved with you in some way to do what we can to help improve on that. And then finally, to pick up on what I think I heard Larry say, maybe we can come up with some kind of compromise solution this morning that will satisfy most of us as a next step, as a way to move forward. I'm hoping for that. And I have some thoughts.
Okay. And just to comment, our next person is Dion Jimenez, and we actually had two other representatives on the panel from consumer and purchaser organizations. Dion is from Service Employees International, and Jean Axis was with AARP. But I think, Dion, you're on.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for that, Karen, because I was just going to mention, yes, exactly, SAU, we also represent sort of the consumer and purchaser voice. And, you know, we definitely were supportive of the report and the recommendations, and we do have a few suggestions of how to improve it. And I do agree with kind of what Susanna and David was talking about if we can try to get a little more specific, and with what Nancy was saying in terms of if there's a way of how we can try to reach consensus, because I think our goal as a group is we want this report to be adopted, and hopefully there's a way that we can find a way to appropriately address some of the concerns that were raised without necessarily getting away too far from our recommendations. And, you know, I wish we had a longer period of time to have met in person, because I think over 2 days we were only able to accomplish so much, and I think, you know, some of the calls for a lot of additional evidence and other things, I think it's hard to accomplish that in sort of the format that we've been working with as a committee or as a technical expert panel. And hopefully, you know, I think we can adopt sort of a longer-term committee that can address some more of these specific issues.
Okay, thank you. Steve Lipstein?
Yeah, good morning. And thank you again for all of the leadership that Kevin and David and Karen have provided. This is kind of a very important undertaking. One of the things that that I did once I saw all the comments from all of the people who submitted comments was I knew a few of them personally, so I wanted to better understand the concerns of those who had voiced opposition in terms of trying to learn whether people were open to receiving additional evidence and would be willing to change their minds or change their opposition if they had additional evidence, because several had cited the fact that they thought the evidence was, and they used the word premature, the evidence was premature to support the overall recommendations for socio-demographic risk adjustment, and I was trying to understand how much additional gestation would be required to take our recommendations from a place of being premature to being full term. I think towards that end, I think what David and Susanna said earlier is very important in terms of the opponents to our recommendations being skeptical and not yet convinced. And so I kind of was able to identify four themes that were common among that skepticism. One was that, you know, a concern, and I'll use the readmissions rate example, that providers who serve low-income communities may have higher readmission rates because they don't do a very good job of providing discharge summaries or discharge planning or patient education or transition of care management. So how do we make sure that socio-demographic risk adjustment doesn't embed substandard care? And so, you know, so I think that's one thing that we need to address. And I actually thought the article that I sent around yesterday that was the Henry Ford Hospital example showed that even with standard and consistent discharge planning, discharge summaries, transition of care management, you still had highly differential readmission rates when people were discharged to high poverty communities. So So I think that's one theme that we heard. The second theme was that that providers who serve low income or disadvantaged communities will continue to do more research and to continue to improve their performance even in the presence of socio-demographic risk adjustment. And so they don't want to, so kind of the skeptics would say, you know, if we socio-demographic risk adjust and it takes away the motivation to improve, that's not a good thing. So I think that's a second thing we need to address. The third one is this whole issue of disparities need to continue to be visible. And this is where we've had our discussions about how you do socio-demographic risk adjustment without making disparities invisible, but either to patients or providers or to payers or the consumer community broadly defined. And then the fourth theme, which is an interesting one that I think we need to address, is this concern that we were making it too difficult on the measure developers. And you know, I raised the issue in what I sent around is if in making it easier on the developers, we make it more difficult on the providers of services to disadvantaged communities. I offer making it easier on the providers and more difficult on the measure developers, but I do think that's a concern that was expressed by the people who were in opposition. So again, those were the four themes that I think I learned about in both reviewing the comments that were in opposition to our recommendations, as well as communicating with a few of the people who voiced that opposition who I know personally. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jean Nuzio?
Yes, good morning. I have just two comments. One is that I think we as a committee have done a great job, but I think we also need to be realistic about what risk adjustment can and cannot do with regard to creating an equivalent playing field for similar healthcare providers. So I think a sort of a realistic approach of where we are today, what the possibility of adding the socioeconomic status and demographic variables would or would not add is something that we need to keep in the back of our minds. And just to provide a sort of a counter-argument to my friend Steve, I don't think developers see it as a burden. I think developers don't want to be restricted or be told, that is, have a prescription provided to us in terms of how we go about developing a risk adjustment model, because there are many different measures that need to be risk adjusted, some of which are better risk adjusted in using an indirect method, some using the linear method, and I think that developers don't want to be put into a box, but allow us to be creative in terms of how we address this issue of providing an equivalent playing field when we make comparisons among providers. So those are my two comments.
Okay. Sean O'Brien?
No comments right now.
Okay. Maynez? Ponce?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you skip over Pam Owen?
I didn't know Pam was on. Is Pam there?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Sorry.
Oh, okay, Pam. Thank you.
Running from a different meeting. I very much appreciate what the members have already said. The part I'd like to go back to is I think it's a nuanced discussion, and perhaps we need to look at the language again in the sense from where the comments are coming, that the nuance of our what I found to be a really fruitful in-person meeting, maybe that didn't come across as strongly that it is a nuanced discussion, because it seemed like the comments that I read it as more black and white than I think I left the meeting feeling like our conversation was. I felt like we had a lot of caveats and sort of it really wasn't black and white.
All right, thank you.
Can I just quickly respond, Dave, here? I don't want to interrupt. That's really important, Pam. I appreciate that. I know several comments have been made like that. If there's a reason, it may have been that since we're one of our main recommendations is different from the current status quo, we probably felt the need to argue that particular change very strongly, and if so, perhaps lost some nuance. So as we go through our discussion the rest of today, if we can highlight those areas of nuance that people felt were in the in-person meeting, lost in the report, should be brought back, let's make sure we do that.
Okay. Lina?
I think that I thought that the comments were very favorable, and even the ones that were not gave specific recommendations. So I was a little bit anxious about this meeting, but I think that it's not going to be such a hard task. One thing is accommodation. The easy thing is the list of adjusters. Some stakeholders suggested, you know, adding from the suggested list, and this something to pose. I feel that the group at one point there was a turn to try to separate the goal of performance and reducing disparities, and I think the two should still be aligned, and I was surprised and appreciate America's health insurance plan emphasize the need to talk about disparities.
Okay, thank you. Sue, Quatch?
Yes, so I was really pleased with the number, the depth, and the diversity of the commenters and their comments, and as I was reading through many of them, I agree with what's been said. The one thing I want to underscore and highlight is this concern around the data burden, and I know that in some of the questions that we had, we're looking to use existing data, and I would really want some more discussion around that. I think in D.C. when we had sort of the breakout group, and I was part of the group where we discussed about the data and the variables we want to use, I really always felt like we needed to extend that discussion and really evaluate the different types of variables that are under consideration. Some of the commenters added a few others that I thought were really good, but at some point, looking to what's available versus what really needs to be improved, I think that is going to be key for us in terms of the data quality and how precise and how accurate it is in terms of making or breaking the risk adjustment method.
Thank you. Okay, Tia?
Yes. First of all, I was very, very impressed by the number of positive comments as a percentage. In cognitive psychology, people often are more motivated to put in their complaints than their praise, and yet we got overwhelmingly positive comments. And I think that's a very good thing, and that's not to discount the ones that were negative. There's learning in those, and we need to take them very seriously. This is an unknown. This is new, and as I said, it's incredible that we got so much support in my mind. I would hesitate to move to get too prescriptive because this is going to grow and evolve and change over future years. So the more we can do to establish a good framework is more important to me than the drilling down to prescriptive elements. And along those lines, any measurement, exists within a system. I mean, and what is a good measurement for one purpose is not a good measurement for another purpose. And to respond to some of the comments that advised us not to give advice on how measurements get used and how they get implemented, I think that would be neglectful. Giving advice is different than prescribing. But to the extent that we have knowledge about the inherent weaknesses or limitations of a measurement, I think we're duty bound to share them. So,
okay, thank you, Nancy Sub.
Hi, good morning. So I just want to go back to the three things that David brought up at the beginning, as I think through those, and I look at masking disparities, and I think we can have some very good answers to that, some ways to maybe reassure people. The lowering the incentive to improve, I think, really comes down to what do you use to incentivize improvement. So I think that there are some fairly easy frameworks to put that in. The one I'm most concerned about is the perception that we're accepting lower standards for people of lower socioeconomic status. And I'm worried about that because much of it is perception, but I think we do have to very thoughtfully think through how we want to give reassurance to that perception. Because I know, sitting around the table with you all, none of us want that to happen. So I think that that's the place where I'm not as sure how we want to address that, but I think it's very important.
All right, thank you. Rachel Werner?
So I guess I'm just going to echo a lot of what's been said already, but as I read through the memo that was put together summarizing the comments and the comments themselves, I was primarily struck by the number of positive comments, and I was thought that the comments were generally overwhelmingly positive. And I was also struck by the fact that many of the negative comments, I think, were around issues that we discussed at length in our in-person meeting and subsequently, and that there's a lot of nuance required in talking about those issues, and so it got a little bit lost in the report, and so some clarification could help a lot in addressing some of those issues.
All right, thank you. And did I miss anyone that wasn't on earlier? Okay.
Can I just ask one thing? This is Susanna.
Yes.
Following on what Rachel said and actually a number of other people's comments, it strikes me, and I don't know if this is helpful, but some of the polarization of the commenters and some of what I think they may have read in the report are, as this is reported, weighing in on should we or shouldn't we risk adjust for SES. And I think if our conversation is about sort of should we or shouldn't we, it's not as productive as if we can try to focus on when should we and when shouldn't we. So getting guidance and there may be people who feel like the answer when should we is always, but I don't think that that's what the consensus of the committee is. And I think that that framing might reassure the people who are concerned, because somebody said this, that I think it was read as being more polarizing than it was intended to be, and so I'm wondering if that shift would help our conversation and our edits.
Thank you. I think that is certainly a good comment and something for us to consider, and appreciate that. So what I'm going to do is just move on to just a quick summary of the comments. Actually, I think let's go to the memo. We're going to be looking at the memo, and then we're going to start working through the themes and having some discussion. Dave and Kevin will help facilitate that discussion, and then we'll continue to see where we end up today. So I think basically everyone has read the summary of the counts of the comments, and we've all commented that it was a large number and a record for NQF, and I think it just speaks to the importance of this topic and the engagement, and certainly starts with this expert panel, and again, appreciate the engagement. We'll go on and move down. And I think we've already talked about some of the balance of the stakeholder comments, and that's one of the things that we want to address in our consensus process, and certainly to keep in mind as we think through these comments and potential resolution or responses to those comments. So let's go on and move on down to the themes. And we're screen sharing, and we realize that there's a little bit of a lag between what we do here and what you see on your screen. We are basically going to be using the memo as our kind of agenda, at least to start with. So the first theme that we wanted to focus on, and many of you have already commented on, is the comments related to masking disparities or masking quality problems and potentially accepting different standards of care for patients with different circumstances. And I think one of the things that is noteworthy is that commenters agreed with the recommendation that stratification was necessary to identify disparities. However, some commenters did object to socio-demographic adjustment for purposes of public reporting and pay-for-performance, expressed concerns of these things that we've already, as mentioned, talked about during the meeting and subsequent calls. And I think that, but there were other commenters that noted that analyses that would be needed to include adjustment for socio-demographic factors would highlight where there are disparities and actually provide more information to bring to the issue of identifying and working on disparities. Some commenters suggested that both the socio-demographic adjusted and stratified data be publicly reported. So that's in a nutshell. And we just identified some questions for you to be thinking about, and then I'm going to turn this over to all of you for discussion. But again, for should the recommendations regarding socio-demographic adjustment be modified in any way? Are there ways to resolve or mitigate concerns about the socio-demographic adjustment and masking? So, for example, monitor for increasing disparities, incremental approaches, more transparency. Should the disparities recommendation, the second part of recommendation one, actually be separate so that it can be adequately identified and perhaps even strengthened? And Kevin had provided some additional suggestions in the appendix. And then I think something that came up in some of your comments, are there additional ways to explain or demonstrate what a risk adjustment does and doesn't do? So from there, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin to help facilitate a discussion of some ideas of how we can address and respond or hopefully resolve some of the concerns that were expressed. Kevin?
Thanks, Karen. So I don't know that there's a perfect way to address this complex problem, but I think one way would be to begin with the first bolded, which is that we bolded masking disparities, masking quality problems, and then different standards, and starting with the masking disparities and thinking about our the first part of recommendation 1A. What we think a response to the specifically to the masking issue should be. I think it's going to be easier if we, although they're clearly interrelated, perhaps to take them one at a time, since some of the public comments actually listed them separately.
David, this is Larry Castellano. Should I jump in, or how do you want to proceed?
Yes.
Let's.
So, okay.
Just identify yourself when you make a comment. Thank you.
Yeah, it's Larry Castellano from Weill Cornell Medical College. You know, we had some discussion, a fair amount actually, during our in-person meetings about whether it made sense to report one risk-adjusted measure, let's just say, in cases where it seems appropriate that SES is important, and we'll talk about later maybe if we need to clarify when that might be. But assuming that it looks like SES is important, you know, we debated whether to report one, whether the measure should be one risk-adjusted measure adjusted for SES, or an unadjusted measure, might be clinically adjusted but not adjusted for SES, and an adjusted measure for SES. And we had, I think, a relatively brief discussion about that, and that, you know, maybe it would be too complicated and too confusing to report both. And, you know, looking back, I was a little uneasy with that at the time, I have to say. And looking back at it and looking at the comments, I actually think that I think we would meet the most serious concerns that I think were expressed quite well if we said, yeah, if SES should be addressed, then the measure should have two components. There'd be one unadjusted for SES and one adjusted for SES, and they'd both be reported. I'm not going to get into the comparing among strata right now. I think that's a separate discussion. I think it's a good one. It's a good way to look at disparities in a more detailed way for quality improvement. But just the adjusted and unadjusted, I really don't think that's too complicated for public reporting. It's two numbers. They're easily explained. And I don't think it's too complicated for payment incentives either. I think one of our problems, and I'm going to shut up in a minute here not to go on at too much length, I think one problem is, you know, our charge was to consider measurement issues and not how the measures would be used. But in this area, it's very, very hard to do that, as we see repeatedly. I think if there is a concern about how two measures would be used, I think it's actually fairly obvious and would go a long way toward meeting the concerns of those who are concerned about what will happen to providers who take care of disadvantaged patients, and also the concerns of those people concerned about masking disparities and giving providers a pass on not improving care for disadvantaged patients. And that is simply you have the two numbers, adjusted and unadjusted, and then you pay based on some blend of the two, and probably based on some blend of the two and maybe on improvement as well. And maybe over time, perhaps a long time, you shift the blend more and more toward the unadjusted score. This is all up for debate, and I'm not sure that NQF needs to recommend that. But I just don't see that it's that complicated to have the two numbers, and I think it would solve a lot of problems.
This is David Hopkins. May I respond?
Yes.
Larry, that's exactly the compromise solution that I had thought of. So I just want to say I totally support that. I think that it is the best answer to those of us who may remain somewhat skeptical and allow for any variety of solutions in the future on payment issues, public reporting issues, and so forth. And I'm always a little hesitant to use the word public reporting because we often think of, oh gosh, this is going to be confusing when we put it out on the web for consumers. So I prefer to think of just reporting to whoever is appropriate. I second Larry's proposal there, and I hope maybe that we could agree on that. That would be a huge step forward, and I think would quiet down the chorus from the skeptics quite a bit.
This is Kevin. I'm gonna jump in here quickly. I wonder whether we should have some focused discussions specifically on this very important issue. We'll get back to the broader issue, but you know, having now that you've raised this, Larry and David, you've responded. I think to have some broader discussion about this key point, which I think does relate very much to one of the criticisms at this point, I think would be helpful. And then we'll come back to the broader issue once we've have more discussion about the issue of whether or not to include adjusted measures that are unadjusted for SES along with those that are fully adjusted.
Kevin, this is Inez. Hello, this is Inez, and I absolutely endorse this. In fact, I think I endorsed this from the very beginning. I think the way you unmask disparities by having the adjusted and unadjusted, and you see how it moves, and I know our work group, and when Susanna presented, you know, it was, you know, there would be, with those two adjusted and unadjusted, you'd see the room for improvement, but also that there are providers that are doing the best they can for seeing a more underserved community. So I'm glad it's put out, and I hope it stays as a response.
This is Norbert Gold. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So I just have two comments, and you know, this may be the path that we'll go down, but I just want to highlight just from a developer's point of view, and both Suzanne and I, in a positive way, disagree, but I think it highlights the issue, which is to say, as I said in my presentation, I said, for me, the poster child is homelessness, and that should be incorporated into risk adjustment, and a very close attention to chronically mentally ill. And both of those areas, just to take an example, readmission. So I just want to highlight that there are going to be many measures out there. If you separate out the risk-adjusted from the socioeconomic, clearly I just want to hammer home the fact that there's not a bright line between the two, and that, in fact, developers can differ. And so what I would suggest as we go forward, if we go down the path that has been suggested by Larry and David, I think it's very important to really emphasize that the developer needs to demonstrate a significant effort to have incorporated into the risk adjustment mechanism as much that reflects socioeconomic status as possible, that's part of risk adjustment. An example, again, being the chronically mentally ill and homelessness, where, again, in a completely positive way, developers can disagree and, in fact, do disagree.
Herbert, do you have a position on the question of whether to include both?
On the question of including both measures?
To include adjusted and unadjusted.
Well, again, I think my perspective, at the end of the day, I believe that initially, so I'm going to temporize by saying that for initial efforts, it should be combined together. I'd have no problem over time for the two to be separate because, in fact, it's exactly the reason that we all support. But initially, I believe they should be combined together. But if that can't go, I just believe also that there has to be a very diligent effort to incorporate into the risk adjusting mechanism as many aspects as of the state of SES.
This is Gene. Just a point of clarification. When you're speaking of unadjusted and then adjusted, are you really speaking about raw values, or are you speaking about values that have been adjusted for clinical patient conditions? And then the adjusted is the adjustment that occurs if a socioeconomic or a demographic variable is added into the prediction model.
Yeah, this is Larry. Since I put it out, I guess I'll respond. So when I say unadjusted, I mean unadjusted for SES, and I think that's what others are meaning too. The unadjusted would be adjusted for clinical factors in cases where it seemed appropriate to adjust for clinical factors, and this is already something that's been addressed, I think, well by NQF and NQF measure developers. So to me, unadjusted is adjusted for clinical if appropriate, but isn't adjusted for SES. Adjusted is adjusted for clinical if appropriate plus SES.
This is Tia Sani, and my apologies for getting technical here, but this is an important technical point in that in healthcare, everything's correlated with everything. So SES is, in fact, correlated with clinical. It has its own distinct value, but it is correlated. So if we're doing, for example, risk adjustment is a multivariate linear regression. We can calculate the best, optimize the adjustment factors using just purely clinical. But as soon as we put SES in, the factors related to the clinical characteristics will change. So if we take SES in and out, do we re-opt? If we have SES in and then we say do it without, does without mean just removing the SES factor without re-optimizing the clinical factors, or does it mean re-optimizing the clinical factors?
Tia, this is Suzanne. I think that you're right that there are real complexities to this, but and I suspect that we can't probably get into the details of them. But I think you could do that either way, and obviously one is more burdensome. But on a higher level, I want to support the suggestion that we indicate in the report that there will be times when the best solution is to provide both pieces of information. I think it is a great step towards transparency, and as Larry said, it's not going to always be a very comfortable thing to have the two numbers out there, but it is going to resolve a lot of the concerns people have. It's going to make it really clear what happens when you do risk adjustment, how big of a difference it makes, how much it's going to help you understand more about a provider. And so in my framework of not should we or shouldn't we, but when should we, I think it would be a great thing to say, and I don't have the right words exactly, but to say there are going to be certain measures under which case we always use the example of Class B. There's no need to risk adjust for FDS, so you would just present a measure that did not include FDS risk. There are going to be other measures, you know, right now it happens with HCAPs, where the risk adjustment for education factors is critical and should be presented just as a single number with the education level adjusted in. And there are going to be measures where it is more controversial, and we recommend, at least in the early stages, that developers present both a risk adjusted for FDS and without measure, and that's going to, I think it's going to help people. I wasn't as much of a fan in the meeting, but I really agree today.
All right, so to dig a little bit deeper there in what you just said, in that I think you just outlined three alternative paths in my mind, because or you added two to what we were previously discussing, in that is our recommendation that they should always be presented in parallel, or that they may be presented in parallel, or that we would rather that they be presented in parallel? Because for sure, I would say that even our current recommendation doesn't preclude them being presented in parallel.
Mm-hmm. So this is Larry again, if I can jump in. I think that was Susanna's comment, illustrates how difficult it is to separate the measurement from the use, right? And so when we say presented, we're kind of presuming for accountability purposes. And I guess, I mean, I agree that when relevant, when SES is deemed important, that both should be presented. But, I mean, I think we can, at a very basic level, we can just say, as we said, I think, that the measure developer should explain why they think SES is or is not important in this measure. And why the measure should or should not or should not be adjusted, if there's no good reason to think it shouldn't be adjusted, then the measure would require two calculations: one of the adjusted, one of the unadjusted. Period. It's another step then to say how these would be used for accountability, and we may want to provide some guidance on that. I think it's fairly obvious, actually. But I think we're kind of getting into the other discussion of when, but I would say if it's something where the patient has to do something, then SES is probably should probably be adjusted for SES. It'd be a strong burden on the developer to show why it shouldn't be. So, Susanna gave the example of Class C, and I think we all agree the patient really doesn't have to do anything for that. It shouldn't be adjusted for SES. You start to look at readmissions or mammography rates or many, many process and outcome measures where they do depend to some extent on what the patient does. Those, I think, unless the developer can give a very good reason, should be SES adjusted, and we would just recommend that they provide two ways of calculating the measure, one adjusted, one unadjusted. We can go on then to recommend that for accountability applications, those two, you know, both be used in some way, and there's fairly obvious ways that they could both be used.
It's Monica Brow here. I came in saying that we should not, in my mind, thinking we should not present both, but as you all are speaking, I can see a compromise. I just need something clarified for me. When we spoke about adjusted versus non-adjusted, can you convince me the difference between clinical and SES? And let me just elaborate for a second. So in our two-day meeting, we had very good detailed conversations about how we would like SES factors to be seen in the same way clinical are. So, for example, if we're looking at someone who has a wound on their leg, everybody accepts now that if they have diabetes, that changes the way you look at the healing of that wound outside of any quality measure. And what I am hoping we can do is say that the fact that the person is homeless also changes the way you look at that wound on the leg and healing. And to me, they're equal. Same thing with something like pneumonia, whether they're an asthmatic or not. We clearly understand that as an issue, but whether they don't have air conditioning because they're too poor to pay for their electricity is not currently looked in. And so I'm having just a little bit of trouble of saying the adjusted versus non-adjusted will still take the clinical issues into account, but not the SES. So I'd love some clarification on that to help me understand that better.
Lipstein, I'm trying to I want to get a little bit above the technical again just for a minute, because I'm trying to think of what I would do as a large scale provider of services, what I would do with both an unadjusted and an adjusted rate. I can see what maybe purchasers may do with two different measures, but as a provider, how would that help me modify human behavior? And so so I have a different construct on this. And I'm not opposed to, by the way, doing adjusted and unadjusted measures. But if every provider, hospital, home care agency provider, could apply a standard methodology that was developed somehow by our government and develop an encounter-weighted poverty rate based on not where the hospitals or providers are located, but where the patients reside and the circumstances that they really live in, so that every provider had an encounter-weighted poverty rate that they could calculate and understand. And then whether or not you apply that poverty rate to risk adjustment methodologies would be based on whether or not that particular measure lends itself to socio-demographic risk adjustment. So what the reason I throw this out as an idea to address this issue is I'm going to give you two examples. We have Christian Hospital in North County, which serves a very disadvantaged community, and Missouri Baptist in West County that serves a very affluent community. They have very different discharge-weighted poverty rates. So what I would like to be able to do, instead of comparing Christian to Missouri Baptist on any outcomes measure, what I'd be better served to do is say, okay, where are the hospitals that have the same discharge weighted poverty rate as Christian, and compare Christian with those providers to see if there are things that Christian should be doing, because they may likely need to spend more money on transitions of care or more money on discharge planning or more money on patient education or more money on home-based services in order to affect the same outcomes that other providers with the same discharge-weighted poverty rate have been able to accomplish. But at least what we will do is stop comparing hospitals who serve affluent communities with hospitals who serve impoverished communities as if they're on a level playing field or a poverty-blind basis. So I think what I would want to see to address the concerns of masking disparities and quality problems is to begin to compare providers, and the comparisons are important, who have equal poverty burdens. And I'm not sure just providing me with an adjusted and an unadjusted measure helps me to do that.
So this is Marshall. But I think that, like, in some ways, like one of the reasons why we ended up with the current set of recommendations was that we saw there was this challenge of separating a pure measurement function, which has been NQF's traditional role, with the application of those measures, but wanting to make that bridge. And also, there was the nuance in discussion, and I think, you know, both for our committee itself as well as for the general public and users, we want to have sort of a simple message. But I think in some ways, like, the feedback and discussion we've had so far shows that there may be a way to have sort of a simple message combined with the more nuanced discussion of how things might be used. So I guess I would come down to, like, sort of three comments here. One is I do support Larry's suggestion about reporting both the adjusted and unadjusted. So it's sort of like the light being the sanitizer effect, that just having those numbers out there, it becomes stark that there are problems that need to be addressed and how they're used. So that sanitizing function would go a long way. A second comment would be that I do think, though, that what Larry is saying is obvious to people, may not be as obvious to some people. And so that having a discussion about different possibilities for use, and so Larry's mentioning things like, well, you know, one end you could just use the adjusted measure for accountability purposes, or you could have some type of combination of the adjusted and unadjusted, or you could reward for absolute thresholds as well as improvement and all. You know, I think all that discussion probably needs to be in there, as well as how that the mix of different ways of using and weighing these factors might need to change over time. So, for example, Robert Johnson's Foundation's comments, they talked about how that over time they would hope that some of the social determinants would become under the purview of a health organization or an ACO or whatever entity, and so that the evolution over time of what is considered to be within a insurer's or plans or organization's purview could very well change over time. The third thing is, I think partially building on what Steve just said, you know, the point about like the second bullet in recommendation one about stratification, it probably doesn't make sense to have it as sort of a separate recommendation. But Steve's made me think about two ways that we might be able to build upon it. You know, initially I think we talked about stratified measures, like your typical, well, you know, stratified measures by race, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status, you know, those type of measures. And I think, again, those are really important ways to do things to basically sort of sanitize, especially in the light. But I think then Steve's comment also made me think about, we had an extensive discussion over some of the calls and meetings about then beyond sort of just the reporting by strata, there are other ways then you can potentially use that for accountability and your application for payment. So I remember, for example, people talked about you could have basically compare like all the states and hospitals in one bin, but then risk stratify outcomes so that you're now comparing apples to apples, but then you're stratifying, you're risk adjusting for differences in case mix, you know, both clinical and socioeconomic status. So that's a way to get some mind stratification as well as in the risk adjustment. But I think so those three different elements then, you know, the plain start, you know, adjusted, unadjusted is number one. Number two, discussion about different methods of then applying methods for accountability purposes and payment. And third, stratification and potentially risk adjustment within stratification. Those would, I think, reflect the more the nuance of the discussion we've had and do it in a transparent way that still gives, I guess, the users then flexibility in how they actually use these measures, but makes explicit some of the pros and cons we thought of and some are forward thinking about. You know, it needs to be addressed, because I think one thing that's driving this is that currently CMS, other payers, largely don't think about this in terms of the complexity of reimbursement reform. Well, they think about it, but they don't implement it. And so I think this would go a long way towards just moving us further along in terms of action.
And this is Nancy.
Sorry. Go ahead, Nancy.
I just wanted to wrap back around to what Monica said earlier, because this is an area I'm having a big struggle with also. And I will say, I'm one of the people that started out with no, there has to be just one number, and I'm certainly willing to compromise if it moves us along, because I feel like having socioeconomic status addressed is so important that, you know, I understand compromises need to be made. But I still go back to what Monica says, you know, there has been a decision that having diabetes changes your outcome in a way that is beyond just quality of care of the physician. And nobody says, well, why should diabetics expect lesser care? Why are we saying that their bar is lower? So that sort of has already been accepted. And now we're coming and we're saying, you know, we really feel that there is data to say that socioeconomic status affects your outcome beyond what a provider or a clinic can control, and it should be adjusted for that. But then we waffle on it. We feel like, well, we should sort of put it out there, but maybe really not. And that makes me uncomfortable. It's like if we feel like socioeconomic status is a determinant that needs to be addressed in trying to drill down to quality and to compare quality, then we really need to feel that way. And if I had to choose, what I would do is put one number out there with everything adjusted that we feel like is appropriate to adjust for the measure, and then allow a very easy route to look at all the unadjusted values from the very beginning, the raw score, the disease severity, and socioeconomic. So then if you wanted to look at disparities or you wanted to look at it differently, you could, but the number out there is adjusted for things that we feel are appropriately adjusted for.
So this is Nancy Garrett, and I agree with that comment, Nancy. So I also have a concern that if we make a strong recommendation that two different measures have to be endorsed, one adjusted for clinical factors and not socioeconomic, and one adjusted for all of those, we're setting apart the socioeconomics and the clinical risk factors, and we're not taking that stand to say, we actually, if there is a conceptual and empirical reason to believe that we should be adjusting for SES, then we should do it. And so it kind of gets back to the way that the NQF process works. I mean, right now there's a measure that's endorsed. There's not a process for having two measures endorsed. I mean, you have to submit two different measure applications. And the endorsed measure is the one that's used in paper performance programs. In Minnesota, we've had some experience where our community organization, Minnesota Community Measurement, we've created some risk-adjusted measures that do adjust for payer status as a very rough indicator of socioeconomic status. But that adjusted measure is buried on page 150 of a 200-page report, and it's not the one that's used for public reporting or for P4P programs. So if we are, it just feels like we're really moving away from a recommendation if we take that stand. So I don't support that idea of saying we need to report both. I support the idea of looking at both in the endorsement process and having that strong recommendation, that stratification, that in order to address disparities, we need to stratify and we need to do that process. So I agree, Nancy, with what you said.
Can I respond to Monica and Nancy's question about sort of why would we think about homelessness any different than we do diabetes?
Go ahead.
I think this in some ways comes to the crux of sort of why we're all in this meeting, and NQF isn't holding a panel on should we risk adjust for diabetes or heart failure. And I think people know this, but I think it's important to go back to it, which is that when we think about socioeconomic factors, the ways in which they impact outcomes are more complex. So they impact people through their lifetime, and when people arrive at the start of a care episode, there may well be impacts that are measurable clinically, that, you know, people arrive sicker, and hopefully we can capture that largely with our clinical risk factors, but maybe not entirely. But the other thing is that there is a long history of disparities in care, and so although I am confident that when a patient arrives to be cared for by Monica or Nancy, the issue is not around quality of care. When we look nationally at the outcomes for patients who are poor or minority, part of what we're seeing when we look at that relationship is mediated by quality. We know that minority patients are clustered in poor quality hospitals, looking at cost of care measures by a paper that Shisha did, and that there is, in some cases, evidence of discrimination within a hospital around how patients are cared for, and sometimes providers are under-resourced, so even though they would or could provide the highest quality, these patients are going to under-resourced facilities, and that gets into the payment piece, but nonetheless, it means that part of the relationship between SES and outcome is through a pathway that has to do with lower quality, and that's what you worry about, whereas there is not the same thing for diabetics. The fact that a diabetic has worse wound healing is not because they are systematically being seen at lower quality providers. It is a biologic factor. So although it is not a black line, a straight, clean line, there are some similar issues. I think that we have to acknowledge that we wouldn't be struggling with this if there wasn't more complexity to the issue around SES as a risk factor, and that we have to acknowledge that it's not as simple a risk factor because of the history of disparities in care.
This is Norbert Goldfield. So in a positive way, I think the comment has already been made with respect to what Bravo Johnson said, and that's how I responded also to Kevin's question to me, which is to say, you know, I believe that there should be one score. In an ideal world, it should be one score to start with, and over time, the institution should be responsible for many aspects of the SES disparities. So I think that's the way to look at it, that over time, and initially, that we should at least consider having both scores together, because in fact, you know, as Susanna just said, the line is not black and white. It's not even black and white with respect to wound healing for diabetics because of availability of this resource or that resource. Thank you.
This is Mary Barker. I was one of the people who thought maybe the complexity of two scores, adjusted and unadjusted, would be difficult for the public to understand, but I would agree with it. And I think, you know, if once it's done, that people will then learn and there'll be education around the two scores, and just like we've done with various things that we've done in healthcare, people learn to what the two scores mean. So I would be supportive of doing adjusted and unadjusted.
Kevin and Dave, this is Karen Pace. I wonder if, in light of some of the recent comments, this would be the time to talk about some of the discussions we've been having about the methods and the. Do you think it would be useful to do here, or do you want to hold on that, Dave?
I guess my first thought is the issues are related, but I'm not sure they're quite the same or directly linear. I think a lot of what we're talking about with the methods, I think, feed a little more into what I'll call the Susanna line of discussion about the issue of whether to do it, whether not to do it, and there had just been some good interchange about some of the patterns and data that might feed that discussion. I think what I'm hearing is the issue of whether our recommendations either could explicitly say or at least be consistent with the idea of public reporting of both adjusted and unadjusted. And actually, if I can pause, I've got the floor for a second. Question to either to Helen or Karen. One of the Nancy comments was that the NQF endorsement would presumably be for just one or the other of those, and then it would be, or you'd have to actually run both variations through separate endorsement processes. And I'm just curious, for those most directly familiar with NQF endorsement, is that necessarily so? Or, for example, could the NQF endorsement ultimately bless an adjusted measure, but in some particular public reporting application, the NQF endorsed adjusted measure could be reported, and also an unadjusted measure, which I guess in this scenario is not endorsed. I wonder if we're just painting ourselves in this discussion in the last few minutes a little too narrowly into a corner.
This is Karen, we haven't had this particular scenario before, but I don't think that it would have to be two different measures.
I agree.
Two different endorsements. The way I would see this play out, if this is the recommendation that when a measure is deemed that it's relevant to include socio-demographic adjustment, that when that occurs, that there needs to be specifications for also computing the just the clinically adjusted measure, and that the two, I think we could say that the endorsement is that the two have to go together. So I think we could, adjust our framework for endorsement based on how these recommendations come down and ultimately get approved. So I don't think that has to be a limiting factor, but
I completely agree, and I don't want that to be the rate limiting step here. This is Helen again. There's been a lot of work that we've really begun thinking about how we better integrate the handoff between endorsement and measure selection through MAP. So I think there may be ways that we could conceive of creating this inside a single measure. And that shouldn't be the rate limiting step. Okay.
This is Nina. I'm wondering, if the problem we're trying to solve right now is to address the concerns that we're masking disparities, I think it has to be better communicated to the lay audience that you need both. You have to do both to look at the disparities piece. So I think that's kind of hard for lay audience, maybe some of us, to understand, but that you have to have both to address unmasking disparities.
This is Sean. Can I weigh in?
Yes.
I feel like the recommendation that you have to do both is kind of based on accepting the supposition that adjustment for SES factors does indeed mask disparities or has the potential to mask disparities. And I don't agree with that myself, or at least I feel like there's room for clarification. When we're talking about the issue of masking disparities, there's a lot of related issues that relate to lowering standards or the possible implications of incentives and how it will impact provider behavior. And it's really when it comes to disparities, there's a couple related issues. There's basically disparities can arise from differences between outcomes within a particular provider, whether different SES categories are receiving different care to the extent they're having their needs met. Disparities can also arise by looking across providers where certain SES groups tend to cluster within providers of having worse outcomes. So I think it was Kevin in the beginning said, well, let's really just focus specifically not on all the related issues, but simply on masking disparities. And so when I think about just masking disparities in terms of disparities that can happen kind of within a provider and across providers where certain SES categories tend to be treated by hospitals that just are not meeting their patients' needs as well, thinking about it literally, for the first type of disparities, taking it literally, does reporting, most of the measures we're talking about are reported the unit at the level of the provider, and we're talking about kind of a single number. So if I know Duke's readmission rate for heart failure, and that's an unadjusted rate, I've learned absolutely nothing about disparities within Duke. I've learned nothing about disparities nationally. Whether I now adjust that measure for case mix or case mix plus additional SES factors that we're going to include as case mix, and that has not really impacted or matched anything related to disparities because there's really no information about disparities in that single number to begin with, let alone the issue. Separately, we definitely encourage presenting stratistic results in order to uncover disparities, but just literally speaking, the act of adjusting or not adjusting that single measure did not mask anything. And then there's a separate question about, you may somehow mask the fact that at some particular provider, that provider is not meeting its patient's needs, and you've masked that by adjusting for SES. And actually, when you look systematically across, hundreds of providers, you may see that hundreds of providers are failing to meet the needs of their patients, and that was somehow you didn't see it because of the SES adjustment. And the comment there, and this is a comment that was made by Alan Zaslavsky, who's another statistician who provided comments, was that if you're, for the purposes of identifying disparities that are related to the clustering of patients by provider, just a report card that lists out a number for each provider are really not the best, is not really the best or most efficient or optimal method for trying to identify and quantify that type of disparities. And it's an important goal to gather information and to identify it and highlight it and quantify it. But we're talking about kind of a different purpose for performance measures. And if you're really for the purpose of identifying the disparities, you should be performing analyses that are really ideally suited for that purpose. And so given that that's not really the primary purpose we're talking about, I don't see it as a major concern about masking disparities, because we can always do appropriate other analyses that get at that disparities question a lot better than what we'd be doing just by reporting an adjusted measure or adjusted plus.
So this is Elise Adams. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Elise.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go? Okay. So I think last time I made that same point, and I agree that it's very hard to have one measure that does both things, right? And so I was sort of against the idea of trying to come up with this magic measure that's able to both measure disparities and account for these socio-demographic differences that we should be adjusting for. That being said, I'm not sure that precludes us reporting both adjusted and unadjusted. And I think part of the reason I say that is that while, yes, I agree that reporting adjusted and unadjusted isn't sufficient for really identifying true disparities either across or within groups, I do think that by reporting both, we also demonstrate some humility and the idea that while we think that this is important to do and that there are certain cases where you might want to adjust for these factors, that someone said earlier, it's not a perfect measure. And so by reporting both, it just feels a little bit more like full disclosure. But I agree that by reporting both, I don't think we can take the leap to say, oh, and then we'll know about disparities too, because I think that requires an entirely different sort of set of steps in order to get that to that quantification of the disparity itself.
Hi, this is David Hopkins. That was a great suggestion, and just to come back to Larry's proposal, I think. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned is, from those of us who were concerned about the original recommendation and the reporting of the measure only one way, is losing the opportunity to gather more evidence around disparities as they relate to specific measures that are going to be endorsed following this recommendation. So I would look upon the research community as an important audience for this dual measure reporting or dual way of reporting the measures, and we will gather much more evidence that way on disparities and how to deal with them and what actually is going on. So one more reason to support Larry's recommendation, I think.
David, the one thing I wanted to add, this is Steve again, especially for the consumer groups, I hope it's kind of becoming obvious that in these communities that serve disadvantaged patients, there aren't multiple providers so that you're going to be able to compare scores from one provider to the other. These tend to be communities that either have no providers or a sole service, a sole source provider. And so the disparities are really when you compare those that disproportionately serve disadvantaged patients versus those that do not. And so since today we're basically reporting measures that are not adjusted for sociodemographic factors, if we begin to report two ways, adjusted and unadjusted, I think most in the provider community would see that as a step forward. But again, there still is going to exist large disparities between communities until we come to grips with the fact that we're still comparing providers who serve affluent communities against providers who serve disadvantaged communities, and that is where a lot of the disparity will continue to exist.
And I think we'll learn a lot more about that, Steve, if we do it both ways, don't you?
I do. But I do think that the opportunity for performance improvement still resides in figuring out a way to compare, to find the best practices of serving disadvantaged populations, especially in those communities that just don't have a local tax base.
Mm-hmm. So this is Larry. Based on the recent comments, I'd make two suggestions. One is, this is obviously up to the chairs, but maybe pretty soon we should kind of call the question. And once we've done that, whenever we do that, I would like to see people discuss the stratification issue some more. And I think if I can just say two more words about that, I don't want to get into that now. I'd rather have finish the discussion we're having. But I think that the stratification question is a separate one. I think it ought to be kept separate, and as some people have highlighted, both in the memo and today, discussed separately maybe. And I'm not sure we've really exactly made clear how that comes into what we expect measure developers to do. So I'd like to see that be a separate discussion and a substantial one. And maybe we can get to that once we're finished with what we've been talking about.
Just a quick response on the issue of call the question. I do agree that we've actually still got many issues in front of us, and the time's gone by. A suggestion I make, which also hopefully is a response, that what I hear here are some positive statements, but also a couple of reservations about just the broad concept of reporting both unadjusted and unadjusted measures. What I'm wondering is whether, as we've done once or twice in the past, once this call is done, Karen, Kevin, I, Helen, we could perhaps jot down maybe two or three different flavors of wording, perhaps with different intensities or with different nuances, about this issue of reporting both, and put it out for the same kind of straw poll ballot we've done in the past and just see where people are. My concern is this conference call format is really tough to work with in terms of a call to question thing. I don't even know how we pull the responses other than one at a time by name. It'd take a long time. I do agree that just in the progress through this call, we're about at a call to question time. But I think the way I would imagine doing that is kind of a really quick offline poll that may allow people to express views about, say, two or three alternatively worded statements about this issue.
Yeah, I would agree, Dave. I think at this point, I think we're probably ready to move on unless somebody has a really burning issue that they really feel has not been addressed by previous comments that they want to make.
Yeah, this is Dion. Sorry, I'm not sure if you can hear me or not.
Yeah,
but I don't know if we're gonna talk about this during the stratification portion. But I just really wanted to put a big, strong plug in terms of, I think it's very important that whether or not we have two scores reported, but that data is actually available to interested stakeholders, you know, with the base data, both unadjusted and adjusted. So if there needs to be different analyses that need to be run, that can happen. And I was also curious if David Hopkins wouldn't mind responding whether or not he thinks the approach of having two scores available would help address the concerns of, you know, SES adjustment actually masking disparities, if he thinks that would help kind of the case of making this more acceptable to some of the consumer groups that oppose this.
Thank you for asking. This is David, and as I've already stated, the answer is yes. I think it would be a big step forward and strikes me as the right compromise under the circumstances. On the question of whether or not to take a vote, sometimes there's enough consensus that everybody could agree that adopting, in this case, I'll call it the Castellino proposal, would be acceptable. Might not be their preferred solution, but acceptable. You could just ask that question, is there anybody who would not find it acceptable? If there's nobody who wouldn't find it acceptable, that we've made a huge stride forward, and you wouldn't have to struggle with two or three different ways of framing it. And having split votes and what to do then and so forth. That's my suggestion.
Yeah, Dave Nairns here. Just a quick response. I thought I heard fairly strong reservations or objections from both Nancy Fuggs and Nancy Garrett, and I wasn't sure, even in our discussion of this, are we talking about a recommendation that both measures should be, must be, could be? If we ask for consensus, I'm not sure I'd be 100% sure what we're having consensus about. I know we're close. I'm hearing what seems like an approach to the landing strip of consensus, but I'm just not sure that it would quite be. I'm thinking about our face-to-face meeting where we eventually got into some very important discussions about the word or versus and. And it took us some while to wrestle that to the ground. So, I'd like to be able to say, yes, we got this settled, let's move on, but I feel like we might steamroll a couple people if we do that.
Could we ask Larry to restate his proposal and see?
This is Karen Pace. Because a couple people also brought up the stratification, so I guess the other option, and I'll just do a check here, having the socio-demographic adjusted score, but having the stratified data available. I think that's what Dion was talking about, having the data at large available to whomever would want it. But I guess the other question is whether stratified data by provider is the other option. I'm not sure if there's anything else to say on this, but are there other proposals besides this one that anyone wants to bring up, I guess is my basic question.
This is Gene Nuccio. The question that I have is there an implicit interpretation of a clinically adjusted score versus a clinically and socioeconomic, sociodemographic adjustment. That is, if the score with a clinical for an agency is a bad score and compared to another one, and then with the adjustment, is the socio-demographic adjustment, the score is good, are people interpreting that as, yes, evidence that the socio-demographic is being masked by that second score? I'm just looking at, you know, we're going to have two scores out there, and they could be different. What is the meaning of that difference?
This is Larry. You know, a couple of points. One is, I'll respond to what you said in just 10 seconds, Gene, but the word compromise has come up here and there in our discussion so far, and I just want to emphasize, and this will lead into the response to you, Gene, that at least speaking for myself, I don't see this as a compromise on principle, or I don't see this as something that we would do to make, even though we don't think it's really quite the right thing to do, but we would do it to make critics happy. That's not the way I see it. I actually think we've made a mistake, and I see this as the right thing to do. And now getting to your point, Gene, I think the unadjusted score, if that's all that's out there, it's clearly going to be unfair to providers who take care of disadvantaged patients. So I think everybody agrees with that. I don't think there's any of the critics disagree with that. If we put out only the adjusted score, it will mask disparities in the sense that, and this is, I think, what the consumer advocates are concerned about, if only the adjusted score goes out there, then it is true that a provider organization that is providing worse care for disadvantaged people could continue doing that forever, and nobody would see it, and there would be no penalty for it, right? So to me, you know, putting both scores out there and enables one to see the data both ways. You can see how an organization is doing compared to everybody. And then you can see, well, okay, if it's doing worse, is it doing worse because it takes care of more disadvantaged patients? So I think it's a compromise, not on principle, but actually trying to balance the conflicting goals that we have. Now, whether to try to, and I think for the measure developers, that's probably it, whether NQF as part of this process wants to give any broad advice about, you know, if you've got two measures out there, how might you use them, is, I think, a separate question that I think we could also discuss at some point.
Well, Larry, can you respond to Sean's comments, and I think also, I think it was Monica who raised it earlier, regarding the point that adjusted and unadjusted may not reflect on disparity, will not reflect on disparities directly, and that there are better methods to do so if that is the intent.
Well, if I understood Sean's point, I would say that, and I may not have, I would say that if you have the two numbers and they're substantially different, you know, that is, to me, is evidence that disparities are important here, and that the fact that the one organization is taking care of more, the fact that an organization has a better score if you adjust for SES shows that it's taking care of a lot of disadvantaged patients. It doesn't show, you know, what the quality of that organization is, really. But so you can see, I think, whether SES is important or not for that organization. I agree that if you want to try to parse out more what's actually going on, then starting to try to get into stratified analyses where you're comparing to others of the same class, so to speak, may be very illuminating. I guess the reason I've wanted to keep the stratified on the one hand separate, on the other hand give it more discussion than we did, is because I think there's a lot of problems, which some of which are in the report and some of which we discussed, a lot of problems with stratification that to me would preclude it being used as the measure, so to speak, you know, some stratified measure. It's just too complicated. So I agree that
probing things more on stratification can help us learn more about disparities. But I think that, you know, for purposes of reported measures, I think the two numbers are fine.
Nancy, go ahead.
Sorry. So I'm not a statistician, so I will certainly defer to anyone on the team that is. But I disagree that adjusting for socioeconomic will wipe away our ability to look at quality. Because if my clinic is doing everything it can to get a diabetic under control, and I know my numbers are not going to be as good as my colleagues in Bellevue, you know, I will have my number. And if there's another clinic that has a similar population to mine and will get adjusted, and they are not doing everything they can do and their quality is less, their number will be less. And so I don't understand why we make this assumption that by adjusting, then we have wiped out our ability to look at quality between providers. And the caveat also I will make with compromise is that, you know, if people feel strongly we need both measures, that's fine. I think it makes it complicated for patients to know what to do with those numbers. And if we stratify, it'll be very complex, I think, for them to understand that. But the other caveat is when we get later on to the discussion of should we give sort of regulations of how these measures can and cannot be used, we will have to say yes to that. Because my fear is exactly what Larry did when he proposed the two scores. He said, well, then we take sort of an average between these two scores and maybe we use that for pay-for-performance. And that's where I cringe, because it's like, okay, so even though we know socioeconomic status is important, we're still going to sort of jeopardize the people that are really trying to provide care.
So, Nancy, it's Larry again. I'm very sympathetic with what you're saying, and the problem is the kind of elephant in the room on this is that nothing we can do is going to fully wipe out the huge level of inequality that we have in the country, right? And I don't think there's a payment formula that can either. But I do think that let's take three providers. Let's take a provider that doesn't have a disadvantaged population and then two that do. And we only report an adjusted number for all three, say. And let's say because it's adjusted, we see the same number, same level of performance for the provider that doesn't have a disadvantage and one of the ones that does have disadvantage, right? And then we see a lower number for the other one that has disadvantage. So it's true, as you say, that the provider that's taking care of more disadvantaged patients will look better. The provider that's taking better care of disadvantaged patients will look better on the adjusted score than the other provider that's taking care of disadvantaged patients and isn't doing as well. But still, they'll both look good compared to the provider that is taking extremely good care of its non-disadvantaged patients. And so they might not be providing as good quality, and they would be able to kind of do that forever without anybody really being able to tell if we only report one number. And I think that's the concern that, I mean, that's the main, as far as I can tell, the main driver of the criticisms we received is that you could do a worse job forever and not be penalized for it and not even have it be visible. So when I wrote that first paper, an AMA-sponsored paper, actually, on disparities, you know, in the discussions we had with lots of consumer groups leading up to the paper, by and large, representatives of disadvantaged groups were very vehement that they did not want one number. They did not want worse care for them just being risk-adjusted away, so to speak.
So this is Karen, and I'd like to ask perhaps Sean and others to comment on this. We've had some discussion regarding methods, and I think this is what Sean was trying to say, is that this question of is the national number being driven, the national difference being driven by, for example, poor patients' care being clustered in generally lower quality providers, so that you're starting with coming up with your expected part of your formula based on the outcome
being driven by those poor quality providers, so to speak. So this is the theoretical. And we've had some discussions with the statisticians and other statisticians about methods where you can actually control for that, so that you are looking at the relationship of patient characteristics while controlling for provider differences. And I think that's part of what Sean was saying, that if the risk adjustment method is really adjusting away differences in quality, that's not the intent. So I don't know if, Sean, you can say more about that, or others on the call that are involved in methods and methodology can make any comment about that and whether that's useful or not.
This is Sean. I kind of felt like that was getting into a little bit of a different topic, because there's some technical aspects to that discussion, and I think just on the basic question of does case mix adjustment pose a problem with masking, you know, my takeaway message is still no. So maybe I'll try to respond. Let me just say one thing, just following up this discussion in terms of one number versus two numbers. I think it's, you know, incredibly important. I mean, I think it's very useful and important to report unadjusted data for a hospital. Because one way or the other, low outcomes at a hospital, at any provider, just a hospital as an example, can show hospitals that are not meeting the needs of their patients. And so when you find hospitals with poor outcomes, that's important information. But the leap to interpret those poor outcomes, to relate that to quality, it's just really not well defined. If you see a hospital with poor outcomes, it's either a value judgment that kind of everybody, regardless of any patient characteristics, should have the same outcomes, which is kind of a very ideal way of looking at things. I realize I'm not making a lot of sense here, but I just say that I don't see that necessarily as evidence of higher or lower quality, because I'm not sure we have a well-defined definition of quality. And the way you make comparisons on things that are well-defined is you compare apples to apples. And so when going back to this point of one measure or two, if I was going to report two measures, I would consider reporting one that was fully unadjusted, because one way or the other, it is important to know about hospitals that aren't meeting their patients' needs. I don't see why you need to adjust that for anything. And then the last thing I'd say is that, although it may sound like I'm saying that our recommendations didn't go far enough, I'm actually not. I feel like it's important to tease out where did we go too far, where is there any overreaching, and, you know, for me, I feel like in the report, there's a lot of should statements, and then because the should statements don't hit the nail on the head, we have to follow up with more should statements. So we should adjust for socioeconomic status, but that's not perfect, so we better do something else, better report it both ways, and we should, you know, when appropriate, we should adjust. Sorry, you know, I know it wasn't that lack of nuance, but, you know, we basically imply that it's on the developer's burden to show that they don't need to adjust for socioeconomic status, where we put in additional caveats that if the factor is not primarily mediated by quality, and that distinction may turn out to have some problems. So, you know, although I may sound like I'm advocating stronger recommendations, I'm bottom line, I kind of favor recommendations that leave a lot of the decision making to the developers.
This is Monica Burrell here. I want to just build on a couple of points from what I had said earlier that Nancy Stugg and Nancy Garrett and now Sean are building on. So I would favor us just for a minute thinking about, if we report two, can we report fully unadjusted versus adjusted? Sean and others have, you know, the question that we're looking at here is the theme of, does SES adjustment mask disparities? And Sean is saying, for a statistical point of view, no. Larry has said that if we have the two different numbers, what they will tell us is what the burden of care of disadvantaged patients as opposed to quality per se. So if that is the case, then why not report the fully unadjusted versus the adjusted? Along those lines, I just want to bring one more factor in. I know we're not talking about paid performance here, but part of the reason that we have 670 comments, and this is a hot issue, is because we're talking in the end about money. And when we We're trying to not worsen disparities or mass disparities, but the truth of the matter is that pay-for-performance programs can worsen gaps and disparities when programs that take care of people with, like hospitals that take care of people with lower SES, then are getting less money. And what they cut from their programs, and there's examples of this all over the country, they cut things like their food pantries, and there are witnesses of violence programs and other things that are needed by this population. So I just want to bring in that point that it's really going the other way also can have an impact on disparities.
This too, I just completely want to support Monica's last point. So I wonder, I don't know if Karen, Kevin, and David can give us some help again on this. I mean, it's come up a bunch of times. This is Susanna, sorry. Because I think probably we all have concerns about fewer resources going to institutions that, if anything, may need more resources in order to meet the needs of their patients. And it's very hard to separate these things. And yet, you know, programs can use measures in different ways, right? So there are programs that CMS has right now, the comes out of CMMI, which explicitly chooses places that do badly on readmission measures and gives them funds to try to improve them, right? So in that case, the worse you're doing, the more likely you are to get funds. So you can put a measure into a program in lots of different ways. A number of people in this group have suggested using improvement scores. And so how the measure is designed and how the program is designed is not the same thing, but there is this concern that anything we do is going to have implications for those payment programs. And it would help if you can guide us about sort of what we should do about that in this context, because I don't want us to make recommendations that are really meant to be policy recommendations and use the measures as a means to do that. But I also think that there's a lot of examples that people are reflecting on where the way the measures get used now is concerning.
Yeah, Dave, that's a wonderful point. Let me do a quick response, and then we'll see what others say as well. I think we all understand and agree that out there in the world there's a very close connection between measurement just from a technical activity point of view and money. And the reason there are 670 comments is money's at play, no question. That said, I think in general we're on more solid ground when we try as much as we can to focus our discussion recommendations on measurement. And if we have to make some observations about the links then to money and what happens in terms of fewer resources, any city providers. I think in the report in its current form, we make those kind of observations when we are trying to make the case that the lack of adjustment matters and can indeed cause harm. And I think in terms of general placement, that's still not a bad place. But if I'm picking up your line of thought here, Susanna, correctly, to the extent we can keep our discussion and our recommendations focused on measurement and on the validity of measurement, on the informative value and the validity of comparisons across plans and providers given different approaches to measurement, I think that's when we're closest to the charge we were given. We are closest to NQF's essential role in the scheme of all the other actors out there. It's certainly fair as we talk about context or as we talk about implications to get into issues of money, resources, whatnot. But I don't think we're on our center of the target or on solid ground if, for example, we start talking about programs to give additional resources to inner city hospitals, for example. That's not really what we were asked to talk about here.
Yeah, David, this is Larry. I mean, I broadly I agree with what you're saying, and I don't think – yeah, we don't have a charge to figure out how to get more resources to inner-city hospitals, right? But the comments that were just made, I mean, really do highlight in a very precise way the fact that for this, in this case, you know, distinguishing the measure from thinking about how it's going to be used, I think is impossible. So, I mean, let's just take pay for performance very specifically. And this is why I think this is a compromise on principle, not a political compromise, you know, what I suggested. If we were to use if we were to recommend just an unadjusted, just an adjusted measure, as we did, and that were to be used for pay for performance, as it will be, right, then we are protecting providers that take care of a lot of disadvantaged patients, which we all want to do, right? Where we don't want them to be unfairly hurt by pay for performance. So, but on the other hand, if the measure is just an adjusted measure, providers that take care of a lot of poor patients can forever take worse care of them and not be penalized financially. And to me, to say that that's okay would be just kind of a political decision that, well, we just want to get more resources to those providers any way we can, which we might all agree with, but I think that does go beyond NQF. So, I mean, again, I think the compromise is between recognizing that whatever number gets put out there or numbers is going to be used for pay for performance. If it's one adjusted number, it is going to raise concerns and concerns among consumers and among disadvantaged groups that you'll be able to take worse care of me forever and nobody will ever know it and you'll never get penalized for it, right?
Larry, this is Steve.
If I could just finish one more sentence. I'm sorry.
Sure.
And I think someone said earlier, and I don't think it got enough attention, I wish I remembered who it was, that we don't know that much about putting out the two numbers yet, and that could be a reason to argue against doing it. But what the individual said, and I think it's true, is there will be a lot of energy going into, I think, how the two numbers can best be used, how we can best understand them, that I think will be very productive and will lead to some progress on the issues that we're talking about here today.
So, Larry, what I was going to say was the measure itself and how you produce it is one aspect of this. The second is that when the measure is applied in pay-for-performance programs or accountability programs, what gets rewarded or punished is the variability of the measures among providers. So what we're punishing is variation, not the score itself. And so if the variation is explained by clinical factors or non-clinical factors, sociodemographic factors, or the lack thereof, it becomes a really, really important dimension of this. So what we recommend is that in the measure development process, the measure developers show their measures both adjusted and unadjusted, and as part of the NQF endorsement process, then there's a decision-making apparatus that decides which of those produces the more relevant comparison of variation in terms of trying to encourage performance improvement. So, I think that producing both adjusted and unadjusted scores to inform whether pay-for-performance should be poverty-blind or poverty-informed is an important thing to do. But I don't think we should go to the point of saying that the variation is punishable or not.
Steve, that may be the case, but I think asking a measure developer to develop the two measures and then asking the committee that's reviewing the measure to pick one of the two, to me that's just kicking the can down the road. You know, it is a different recommendation and it's letting each committee then that reviews measures make its own decision each time. And I don't think that will work very well. I mean, I do think we have a decision about should we recommend that one or two is included by the developer and then approved or not approved by NQF.
Just to clarify, Larry, are you suggesting that in addition to the adjusted measure that there be transparency in the unadjusted, and then people have raised, well, maybe that should also include measures that are unadjusted for clinical status or even just pure raw measures? So can you clarify exactly what the proposal is that you're making, Larry? Is it just two measures, or is it making the data behind this more transparent and available?
I'm proposing that measure that if so let me be very, very specific. If the measure
depends on in some reasonably meaningful way on the patient having to do something that the measure should be, that SES is then a factor. And when SES is a factor, the measure developer should tell NQF how the measure will be calculated, the score on the measure will be calculated in an adjusted and an adjusted unadjusted way. And when I say unadjusted, I mean, we can debate this, but I would favor that the unadjusted means, yes, adjusted for clinical factors, but not adjusted for SES. And then the adjusted measure adds in the adjustment for SES. And I recognize there's some technical issues with collinearity and so on and so forth. I'm not sure that should hang us up right now. So unadjusted is clinically adjusted, but not SES adjusted. Adjusted is SES adjusted. If SES is relevant, they got to tell us how both would be calculated. And then, you know, it's a further issue then, which we may or may not want to address, and possibly not, how the world would use these two measures. But I think there would be a lot of productive debate about how the two measures would be used. And I think people are not that dumb that they can't understand two numbers, I don't think.
So this is Nancy Garrett. I just wanted to react to a couple of the last comments. I think, I mean, what Sean said about that a lot of this discussion, we're really accepting the assumption that we're masking disparities by doing SES risk adjustment in the cases where there's a conceptual reason to do so and empirical evidence. And, you know, we've talked a lot in this committee about the balance we're doing here between the risk of harm related to providers being penalized for taking care of disadvantaged populations versus the risk of potentially masking disparities. And so I would favor an alternate proposal, which is to really strengthen the disparities and the stratification recommendation of recommendation one. I think we should pull it out as a separate recommendation and really emphasize that if you want to analyze disparities, that's absolutely something that we need to do. Giving a single number is not the way to do that. The way to do that is to stratify, to understand the groups you're looking at and what are the differences, and then dig into why those differences are happening and try and address the disparities. So I would favor kind of what's in the memo here about pulling that disparities recommendation out and strengthening it. I am concerned, depending on how we do this, if we're really going to recommend two numbers. You know, we've got 56 out of 68 commenters who are in support of recommendation one with no changes. And so we need to balance that. I mean, we're getting a lot of support for the way we put this forward.
So this is Karen. I know we promised a break, so maybe I think we should probably take a quick break and let people get up and move around and take care of things if they need to. So why don't we, it's almost 1:15, why don't we reconvene at 1:25? And we'll leave the line open, but just want to, people can put their phones on mute. We'll reconvene at 1:25.
Good. Thanks, Karen.
Okay, everyone. This is Karen. I think we'll try to reconvene. Are David and Kevin online?
I'm here.
You all? Okay. Do you want to start us off in terms of how we should proceed? We've had a good discussion about the two-number issue, but what are your thoughts about moving forward?
Dave here. I mean, first of all, again, thanks to everyone. It's a difficult process to not be able to see each other and read smiles and frowns and nods and hands in the air and that sort of thing. And you know, as before, people have been productive, people have been courteous, people have been respectful, lots of good ideas, and I think this has been really good. We've diverted, as we might expect, a little bit from the planned sequence of topics, but I think it's extremely good and useful, and I think we've done fine, because basically what we've had in front of us, I think, is a significant topic of discussion that may bring us closer to some common ground between the original high level of consensus in the panel and all the positive comments that we've received, all of that on the one hand, and the concerns by purchasers on the other hand. If we can find a way or two in which we can speak to some of the concerns by the purchasers without sacrificing principle, without breaking up the consensus that we've had on the panel. I think it goes without saying that that's a very good thing. Increases the chances of our recommendations actually being adopted at the NQF board level. So the amount of time we spend on what I'll just call the two-number topic, I think has been extremely good. I think we still have perhaps a bit of wordsmithing and checking with everyone to do on that point. My suggestion, I think, would be to try to use the remainder of our time on two or three other significant issues that Karen had in front of us in terms of the memo and the slides. We'll obviously have to work through those a bit more quickly than we might have otherwise. But I'll just say I've been very, very pleased with what we've done so far today.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I would echo Dave's comments. I think that this is a really important point, and I think it was worth the time that we spent in fleshing out everybody's views on it.
Dave and Kevin, could I suggest the next big question that maybe we could address and maybe a little more briefly, but is the question of when to apply these principles. That's been raised a number of times, and it's in the context of a measure developer scratching their head because they didn't originally come to approach whatever measure it is that they're working on with the thought that socio-demographic factors should be incorporated in the measurement. It occurred to me as I read and reread some of the stuff we've been through in this journey that when we first started out, I think that some people were concerned about those measure developers who have been very eager to include SES in their measures, and NQF has prevented them from doing that. So recommendation one, as I read it and reread it, it finally hit me that it was probably more addressed to that situation. Now flip it around to a developer that is not inherently thinking about incorporating SES. Under what circumstances are we saying to that developer, you've got to do this, whatever this is, whether it's the two measures, the two variations solution or whatever. But is there some way we can be more specific about that?
Yeah, Dave here again, quick response. Yes, indeed. And I think our challenge may be to try to weave together a couple of very closely related lines of phone call and email exchange that have been going on in the last few days. And let me see if I can tee this up a little bit, and then, Karen, I'm hoping you can be the glue that holds this together here in terms either of what appears on the PowerPoint set, and I'll try to do the best I can. There has been some discussion that included a phone call yesterday afternoon with the statisticians who are on our panel, as well as Alan Zablowski, who I think most of you know, who's done a lot of disparities work based at Harvard. Kind of where this got started is during the open comment period, I had an email exchange with Alan. He's, as you know from his comments, very supportive of our report. But he began thinking about some analytic methods that might speak to this question of, at the front end, when is it appropriate to do adjustment and then when is it appropriate not. And as a non-statistician, I'll say it fundamentally had to do with some issues of what sort of patterns do you see in the within provider variation or disparity related to a factor like poverty, and how does that relate to the between provider issues? And there was a lot of email exchange. There was a phone call yesterday, and I think I may at some point here turn to Sean to talk through that a little more. And I think that and Jean as well. So I think this is a good time to get into that. I think also then we ought to open the door to Susanna, who's been thinking about these issues and also had sent some things last couple of days, I think, related to this point. And it just also, I think, speaks to the point that she made in the opening of the call about framing our discussion in terms of when and when not to adjust rather than more simply yes and no. The art here and the trick is obviously how do we weave these two things together if it is indeed the time to do that. For those who are involved in either of those threads, open a suggestion.
This is Karen. I think that sounds good, Dave. I do think that the thing you brought up about the discussions with the statisticians is relevant because it directly speaks to the concern about risk adjustment, adjusting away the quality differences, or the fact that poor people are just generally getting poor quality of care. And I will ask if Sean might talk about that in a little more detail so that we have some understanding of that or discussion.
Sure. So this is Sean. I'm going to try to relay some of the comments from Alan, the statistician, Alan Zdrosky, and our subsequent discussion. But as background, I'll just say two words about how I think about some of these issues. The concerns about masking disparities, I think in some of the comments reflected not necessarily, I guess I'd distinguish kind of concerns about scientific issues and flaws in statistical methodology that might have unintended statistical effects. So you want to measure something, but you end up adjusting away the thing you want to measure, and you apply these counterproductive statistical adjustments. Versus just a more general type of objection that there's something that hits us in the face about applying adjustment that kind of implies a double standard, and it seems to have kind of some ethical just uncomfortableness that it, we may apply adjustments that on the surface appear to value different patients differently. But really then, you know, I think the question that Alan was addressing was from a statistical perspective, is there some flaw in adjustment? Or would we, if we start with the goal of basically measuring provider differences, would we adjust away those differences by accident by doing a case mix adjustment? And the first point he made is that disparities can arise through two different mechanisms, and it's worthwhile distinguishing them. And you can think about it within unit, like a unit being like a hospital or a physician or a provider. You can think about within-unit disparities whereby members of a disadvantaged group receive worse care or have worse outcomes than other patients within that same unit, and then between-unit disparities whereby members of disadvantaged groups are more likely to receive care from units who are overall lower quality. And the point he made in his initial comments, and then there was more discussion about these, is basically that you don't end up adjusting away between the quality differences you want to measure because it's only the within-unit effects that are estimated and controlled for when you do case mix adjustment. So you basically, by ensuring that you're kind of always comparing apples to apples, that is will allow you to control for differences within providers, but it's really the between-provider effects are interested in estimating and they won't adjust that away. Then I think when Karen and Alan had a further discussion, she pointed out the way that case mix adjustment is like often implemented, it's not so obvious that it's always that risk modelers are always explicitly adjusting away the within-provider effects in order to make apparent the between-provider effects. And so the statement that we're okay because we're always controlling for within unit effects is there's some difficulty with that, and it turns out some statistical adjustments may have unintended effects, and I guess the message would be that it's not a property of case mix adjustment in general. If there's certain things that, you know, all statistical analyses have pitfalls and limitations, and the type of analysis really needs to be matched up with the objectives and handled appropriately. But there are definitely statistical methods that do not lead to this bias. And just to recap, I mean, the issue we're talking about is the same one we've already been talking about where patients may tend to cluster in lower quality providers. And just the bottom line, and I'll pause and start again. But the bottom line is that there are appropriate statistical methods that can tease out the within unit effects and make apparent the between provider quality differences that we want to estimate. But not all of the analyses that are done for performance measures are actually doing it or doing it what we might on the surface expect they're doing.
Dave here, and I guess trying to bridge this out to a couple of things. I think even though this discussion for a while may be highly technical, I think we're touching on dynamics that Nancy Suggs captured quite eloquently before the break, talking about if you're serving disadvantaged patients and the numbers don't look good, it could be A, because you're not doing a good enough job, but also just as rationally, it could be you're doing a wonderful, fabulous job, but some aspects of disadvantage are still affecting the outcome and it's outside of your control. And as we slide back to the technical side, the issue is can that distinction in causes be reflected in some patterns between within unit and between unit variations, and there seems to be some hint that perhaps they can, and that we didn't really have that in our discussion earlier. There are a couple published papers on this point that sort of illustrate the pattern. So even though this could get quite detailed here for a while, I just want to reassure the non-statistician folks that we're not going to venture too far from objective reality that most people can experience. And one other thing is we're going to use the term provider perhaps in here, but for friends from AHIP who may be following this, what we talk about here relates to plans as well as providers of any type.
David, this is Larry Castleman again. I mean, if the question is, I think the question you started off with was, when should something be done about risk adjustment? Is that correct?
Yes.
So, to me, the guidance would go, to developers would go like this: tell us whether you think the measure you're proposing, whether performance on the measure will be affected by things the patients do or not. And tell us this based on evidence, if you have it, and on logic, right? So logic tells us that Class C does not depend on patient behavior and should therefore plausibly not be subject to SES risk adjustment, whereas other things, by pretty obvious logic and or by evidence, might seem to be. So tell us, you know, tell us whether you think the thing needs to be adjusted or not. Give us your arguments, and then if you think it doesn't, it ought to be adjusted, tell us how you're going to calculate each of these two measures, and that's it, pretty much.
Yeah, and actually, I was Dave back here again. I was taken by your very clear phrasing in this. You know, is there something that patients do that matters in the outcome? I'm not sure we had that so clearly captured before. I'm thinking as we go along here whether it's going to be possible to bridge that clear and simple concept to some of these other more technical things that have been flying around the last couple of days about the within and between. At a gamble here, but hopefully going to a good place. Susanna, does any of this tie into the thoughts that you've had on this sort of basic question we have of how do you deal with the when and when not, and what sort of guidance we can provide?
Sure. So I think one thing that I want to say just for clarity is that I think that when we talk about the idea of masking disparities, there's been some, we actually said this in the in-person meeting as well, it's not the most useful phrase, because I think actually we don't all know what we mean by that. So I just want to explain conceptually what I think is people's greatest concern about what the effects of risk adjusting for SES is, which is that the way many measures are constructed, you have an expected rate.
adjustment. So what you put into your risk adjustment creates the expected, and you aggregate the expected for all your patients, and you compare them to some version of what actually happens with all your patients, right? And so when you set the expected, whatever you risk adjust for is setting what your patients are compared to. And so the concern is that if you set that expected with SES included, and if in general SES patients are doing worse, you then can have a provider who objectively has worse outcomes, whether or not that's because of worse quality, and a provider who objectively has better outcomes, who are judged to be the same. So they are both considered to be doing as expected or average or considered to be doing good, and one of them, its patients are actually experiencing much better outcomes than the other ones, whose patients are actually experiencing much worse outcomes, because that provider has, the one with the worst outcomes, has more low SES patients. And what I think originally when the concept of masking disparities came up, it was that disparity in outcomes. It becomes invisible that this provider with more low-income patients, their patients have worse outcomes, which is a little bit different than masking quality, which I think is
yes.
also a concern. But I just wanted, I think we mix, are we masking quality or hiding quality differences with are we hiding, quote, disparities? And there's no question whether you think it's a good thing or bad thing that if you set a different expected for your low SES patients, a facility can look just as good as another, even though their patients, in fact, are experiencing worse outcomes just because they have lower SES patients. That doesn't tell you whether that's the right thing to do or not. But I just wanted to remind people that I think that the root of some of the concern about masking disparities was what you don't see is that this hospital is being called just as good even though its patients are doing worse because it has low SES patients. And that, to some people, and it is uncomfortable. The quality piece, and I don't know quite, I'm trying very hard to link this to the pieces that Sean was saying because I don't want to divert us. I think the quality piece is whether or not those differences in outcome, and I'm sort of saying the same thing again, but I think it's worth repeating, are primarily due to inherent differences in patients that can't be influenced by providers or inherent differences in quality. And it seems to me that if the differences are predominantly due to differences in quality, then that is going to happen probably at both a within and between unit level, and you will lose at least some, if not all, of that. I'm going to pause there because I'm worried that I'm not answering the question you want me to address.
No, actually, the very last thing you said is sort of tying it back to me. That, you know, we've had some concerns and some written comments about this phrase of not primarily mediated by quality, and we have been challenged to either remove it or to explain what it means. And what I've picked up myself in a couple of these recent days discussion is, and I'll now slide back, I hope, right directly to your phrasing, that if the effect actually is mediated by quality, if you're looking at a data set in which you have both within and provide within and between unit effects, you should see both. However, if you only see within, you see no between, that suggests that the issue is not primarily mediated by quality. Now, I've just oversimplified this by a ton, and Sean is probably cringing, but I guess that's where I see some of these things coming together, that there actually are some patterns in data that we can describe without getting way too technical in any revised report that actually make this verbal concept a little more concrete and might provide some guidance to developers and future review committees.
And maybe it would help if I could ask Sean just quickly, if Sean, let's take black and white patients, we knew in an extreme case with a particular outcome that the entire difference in outcomes between black patients and white patients was inadequate care for the black patients, whether they're going to worse quality providers or they are being differentially treated in front. We knew that those
differences in outcomes were due to differences in quality. What is the effect of risk adjusting for race?
Well, to the in a very ideal hypothetical like that, I think you could get away without adjusting for race, but I would probably make the point that if you adjust for race, you're still going to pick up, you're going to be able to still identify providers that are doing better or worse at caring for their patients, and that, you know, the outcomes kind of are agnostic to the mechanisms that lead to good or poor outcomes. So you can, you know, everything is relative, and you're basically going to pick out the providers who are doing better, you know, better than typical on black patients, or better than typical on white patients, and it may not be typical, may not be the ideal standard that you would like to compare to. You'd like to compare to maybe some standard of everybody, you know, has the outcomes of high income patients, or, you know, of the least advantaged groups. But, you know, if they're kind of currently set up to compare outcomes to, you know, across providers, and for that purpose, I don't think an adjustment for race in your example would prevent the ability to identify better or worse providers. And I would say also the answer a little bit depends on, you know, whether you're looking at doing a direct or indirect standardization. So I think some of the answers.
But if you're saying that typical is poor quality, I'm not worried so much about whether I can tell people who are doing better on poor quality or worse on poor quality. I am going to set typical as, you know, expected, which is, in my idealized scenario, is worse quality, right? I mean, I think that, I guess I'm trying to really make clear what the risk is, given that we know in this country that some of the worst outcomes are based on poor care, and it obviously differs by the SES factor and the outcome you're looking at.
This is Steve. Just to take this a little bit out of the theoretical back to the practical for a moment. And using Susanna's example, if you get different outcomes between the black patient and the white patient, and you're trying to ascribe that to a differential in quality, in the real world, you can infuse a whole lot of resources to try and offset that that differential outcome. But then if you produce the same outcome for the black patient as the white patient, but you spend twice as much to produce that outcome for the black patient, there's another measure, it's a value-based measure, which says that the quality of the outcome divided by the cost of the outcome equals value. You're still going to punish the institution that spent twice as much to produce a better outcome. So it isn't just a quality differential, and I think to have the conversation about quality independent of the resources available to produce outcomes is to say, let's pretend the world is the way the world really isn't. And so I do think that to ascribe the difference in outcome, just the differences in quality, is a really hard thing to do.
Well, and this is Tia, and keep in mind, quality is a broader concept than just one particular health event. So the outcome of a hospital stay may be very dependent on the quality of care that the patient has received for years. An example, a birth outcome. You know, that's going to depend on the prenatal period and perhaps the mother's entire health history. So to say that a hospital has poor birth outcomes and it's race related it could be related to the quality of mom's care, but not necessarily what happened in the walls of the hospital.
Right.
This is like operationally, what discussion are we having and why are we having it? I'm not exactly sure that I understand.
Yeah, Dave, I realize that sort of struggling teeing this up. I think the thing I'm trying to pull together here is back when we were working on the wording of the draft report, we introduced this phrase, not primarily mediated by quality. I think I'll say Susanna suggested it, although I think I've certainly favored it a number, and it's in the report. And then in many of the comments, we've had suggestions back from all kinds of different people that not sure what it means, not sure it can be operationalized, not sure how that provides guidance to developers, what should we do with it. So I think some of this discussion is about that, and the reason that the various technical discussions, including the within and between, came up, and I think are relevant to this, is I think that represents, although expressed in technical terms, sort of an answer to that challenge, that there actually are some patterns in data that can speak to this question of what that phrase means. And then I think while we're on that same topic, that this the analytic methods that look carefully at within versus between factors also speak to this separately stated concern about masking disparities. And that's where, for example, the Susanna question to Sean a few minutes ago is, in a certain scenario, is there actually a method by which you could adjust for race that would not completely mask quality disparities related to race? So, unfortunately, we've got a few things flying around here at the same time, and we've got a technical overlay, but somehow this seems like the time in our four-hour block to try to work through a bit of this, because I do think that we've got a couple of positive avenues in front of us to speak to concerns that have been raised, either about this not primarily related to quality question and about the masking question.
So, David, yeah, it's Larry again. That was very thanks. That helped me a lot. You know, just one thought, and I wouldn't presume to take a position on this, but just to throw it out for people who can think about it better than I can. I mean, the phrase, you know, not primarily mediated by quality. It is, you know, it really opens up a can of worms as we've discovered. And I wonder if the concept that, you know, going back to that just simple concept, just logically, is this something where the patient's behavior is likely to affect the result or not, could be a substitute for that phrase, in effect. And, again, I don't mean to take a position on this because I think I would be foolish to do so, but could the one, which to me seems pretty straightforward, I wonder how much disagreement there ever will really be on whether patients doing something or not doing something affects the result. Could that substitute for this very thorny issue of, you know, not primarily mediated by quality?
Yeah, no, and I think that's a fair question. I think we're just exploring approaches that the group can think of to address some of these challenges or criticisms that have been made.
Could we also give examples that would illustrate our thinking? Like, we have talked about the difference between central line infections versus readmissions and the fact that the role of the patient and the impact of the role of the patient in both.
You know, I think some of that's in there, but it's just not highlighted very, very much.
And I'll say on the role of the patient, this is Susanna, you know, when you highlight a case where the patient has very little role, like FASCI, it makes a lot of sense that might be an example where you would not want to risk adjust for FDS. But I would say when you do the reverse, that's a very problematic task. To say we, as providers, if the outcome depends on the patient doing anything, then we're less responsible. When there's a lot of data that sort of what we do at discharge from the hospital, when we're giving instructions, when we're talking about medications, which medications we choose, has a tremendous impact on what patients do. So I wouldn't say if there's any role of the patient, then you got to risk adjust for FDS. I think that's going to be a problem.
This is Elise. I agree with that. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Elise.
I would say I fully agree with that. I mean, I think that, unfortunately, it's not less thorny than the quality of care comment that we made before. And as I recall, the reason why we stated it that way was to say, you know, we don't want to mask quality differences, so let's just say up front. I understand that it's hard to say, okay, then what is that and how do you measure it? And I get that. But I'm very wary of this idea of saying, well, patient behavior is really sort of the determining factor here because of the reasons that Susanna just sort of outlined.
this is not, but I go back to Steve's comment on it's twice as hard with some patients as others. I mean, I agree that with any patient, if the provider puts in sufficient energy, the results will be improved. But to say that if you take someone who speaks another language and has a third grade education and maybe different cultural beliefs and no transportation and on and on and on, and you say, well, the provider should be able to overcome all those problems and get just as good a score as they would if they were taking care of someone like the people on the phone here. Yeah, that's true. In theory, you could. But in practice, it's pretty unfair, I think, to the providers who have to take care of the patients that or choose to take care of the patients that need so much more help. And that, again, why I think the concept of does the patient role matters is important. It's not to try to excuse the provider, but it's to try to say that it does matter to the results on average how hard it is to take care of the patient. It's a little like saying, there are poor people who grew up in the barrio or in the ghetto and get into Harvard. So therefore, we don't need to actually worry about giving any extra help to those disadvantaged people. Because look, in fact, there were comments like that. Well, some health plans are able to do just as well when they take care of disadvantaged patients. Well, that's great, but on balance, disadvantaged people have a tougher road to hoe, and so do providers who take care of them.
So this is Nancy Garrett. In the report, the phrase not mediated by quality, I was one of those people, I felt that was confusing. I don't think we really needed that, because I think we very nicely laid out there needs to be a conceptual link, there needs to be empirical evidence of a link, and I'm not sure exactly what task we're trying to do right now, but I don't know that we're going to be able to define very specifically exactly what that conceptual link is going to look like, because this is, the science is early on how to do this well, and we have such limited time, and we have a report due in a month. I feel like by saying what we said, we allow then future people working on measures to really get into the details and figure it out. But I don't know that we can neatly give the criteria for what that conceptual link would have to be.
Dave, back again. I'm just sort of trying to monitor extent we are making forward progress for or not, and I see this is kind of bumpy waters here. I'm wondering, and this is largely a passive suggestion to Karen, Kevin, others, the statistical discussion has been kind of complex. I don't think we have made an effort to get any kind of written summary in front of people in terms of how it might speak to this question of either the masking disparities or the phrase not primarily mediated by quality. Maybe that's a challenge that the three or four of us should take up sort of immediately after this call next day or so, put some things out to the whole group that they can think about and react to. And basically, we would be talking about proposals for things that could be woven into a revised version of the report, because I realize as we go through this discussion right now that either I didn't tee it up too well or there are a couple missing logical links that we need to make sure we're clear to folks. Because I think in my mind there's a positive and useful connection between some of the technical issues that were included in emails from Alan and others and some of the challenges we're given in the comments that we're obliged to speak to. But I think for the whole group who's not seen all that, we just need to make those connections clear and then sort of raise the question of what do we do with them. But I've got a feeling we can keep bouncing around here for quite a while and not make much forward progress.
This is Karen. That sounds good. And I think, part of it will be just useful in responding to some of the comments. But I think that's fair enough. It is hard to talk about these things when everyone has materials in front of them, much less kind of in our conference call environment. So I think that's a good suggestion for us to move on.
Can I just make one last point? I agree with that. To follow up separately, but I think the statistical discussion was addressing a very specific scenario, that had to do with basically the tendency for different FCS groups to cluster within providers, and the question, like, wow, could the people who are raising these issues about masking disparities be right after all? But that was a very specific scenario. And even taking away that scenario, and I think there's some assumption that maybe that knowledge of that scenario and concerns about that scenario was what was driving a lot of the, you know, the majority of the concerns about maximum disparities that were received in the comments. And I don't actually think that was what was driving the concerns. I think that when we asked Susanna for her kind of take on the approach, I mean, the first consideration she raised was really that measures are calculated usually with a model that calculates an expected value, you know, your expected outcome rate, and that if you estimate that model, including SES factors, you're going to, you know, potentially have a lower expectation for different SES subgroups, and that, you know, may not be desirable for incentivizing improvement. It may not, may be uncomfortable ethically, et cetera. But that same concern is present without respect to any of the statistical discussion we're having. So I just say that I'm not sure that we needed to even bring that up in a way. I think there were some nuggets from that discussion that can definitely be used to inform and better respond to recommendations and perhaps even refine recommendations. But I don't think it was going to solve the people's uncomfortableness with the masking disparities issue. And I think where instead, given, you know, if what I'm saying is right, that it's, that people were not identifying that specific scenario and that was not the root of their concern, and it's this more general concern that, basically I just think there needs to be a little more of a critical reflection on what does it mean to say that we don't want to accept lower standards, and does that resistance, what problems do you run into, and inconsistencies, and more discussion, you know, basically the same point that Steve made, you know, that, okay, if you're saying that you're expecting equal outcomes for all patients, is that, you know, what do you do when it takes twice as many resources to achieve the same outcomes in group one compared to group two? And, you know, basically, you know, my feeling is that position implies a lot of value judgments. And value judgments are okay, but, you know, make them explicit. But the way, you know, statistically we try to get away and rely on as few value judgments as possible, is that when there's consensus on a value judgment, it's not very problematic. And everyone on this phone call would agree that for any SES subgroup, take any given patient with a set of characteristics, the provider that's going to take care of that patient the best is the better provider. So the one that's got the better outcomes is better. So whenever you're kind of stratifying and looking within one set, one SES category, there's nothing poorly defined or ambiguous about the comparison between two providers. But it's when you start doing these comparisons that are looking at how one provider does in low SES patients to how another provider does in high SES provider patients, at that point, when you're making a judgment about which one is best, you're either making, you know, a value judgment that every provider ought to have the same outcomes no matter what their resources it takes, or a scientific judgment that there's no way plausible that those differences could be impacted at all by SES factors causally. But those are a lot of judgments, and the only way to avoid those judgments is to kind of do the risk case-mix adjustment approaches that enforce a kind of apples-to-apples comparison.
I know we're trying to move on, but I just want to say again that there's a lot of evidence that in these cases, we may at times be using race or SES, thinking that we're accounting for one thing, but in fact it is a marker of the quality that those patients are exposed to. So you could say the same thing about patients with complications. I mean, choose something that actually is a marker of quality. If you set it as part of your expected, yes, then you're comparing providers who have similar cases, but you're comparing providers with similar poor quality. That's the risk. I'm not saying it happens every time, but there are going to be value judgments. But I just want to be clear that the risk is a statistical one and not just a value one.
And so if you use indirect standardization, there is a problem, and there's ways to not have that issue by using approaches that differ from conventional indirect standardization. It's not clear that the models that are used by CMS for their readmission measures don't necessarily have that problem. But some approaches, this gets kind of into the technical, but there's
right.
Susanna, there's
much evidence, there's actually a lot of evidence now that suggests that some of the variation is not attributable to differences in quality, but differences in attributable to the patient population being served. And so if we're going to indiscriminately compare outcomes, whether dependent on the population you're serving, to say that the literature says that that's mostly related to quality and not related to patient population, just there's a big difference of opinion on that matter.
Oh, and please don't get wrong. I'm not saying that what I have said consistently is this is really different for different outcomes. There are plenty of cases on both sides of the complex issue. I am only saying that because of the concern that in some cases the way that SES plays out has to do with quality rather than inherent. In some cases, we need to be clear in our recommendations, as I think we currently are, that you want to take that into consideration and not be indiscriminate in just putting it into models. So I totally agree with you, Steve. There's lots going on here. This is not simple.
Suzanne, I'm wondering if you could share some of the thoughts that you had shared with us about how to actually operationalize the decision as to whether or not to adjust. Because I wonder if putting it in a little more practical terms might help move us forward here. And I thought you had some you know good insights there.
There's an echo on the phone. Thank you.
Is there still an echo? Okay.
You're good.
Oh, now I'm hearing it too. Okay. I will briefly. I actually thought, I'm very interested in what Sean is saying. I work closely with the statisticians, but I am not a statistician, and I think it might be useful. I'm happy to raise a couple of issues, but I think the idea of cautiously trying to put out some ways that you could operationalize this would be good, and we probably can't do it in the next hour on this call. So I'll say at a high level some of the things that we have seen done and that we've suggested that could be, I think, used as examples of how in cases where there's uncertainty about whether the primary mechanism for SES is through inherent patient factors versus quality factors. So there may be cases where based on evidence in the literature, conceptual model, there isn't a question about that. But in the case where we're uncertain how much the pathway through poor quality is the way that SES is manifesting or leading to work outcomes versus sort of inherent factors that providers can't influence, you might be able to start to disentangle this. And I suspect there's lots of people on this call who have some good suggestions as well. So, you know, I started with the very simplest thing. You know, we want to look at whether there is, at a patient level, a relationship. We want to look at whether that relationship is there after you've accounted for clinical factors. Because we have found that much of the impact of SES is picked up by the clinical factors because it has we're looking at Medicare patients, and I think it has a profound effect on sort of the clinical state when they first arrive, but it may not be all of the factors, that's all the effects. And that you want to look at how providers with lots of low SES patients do on a measure compared to those without, because we have also found in some measures there's almost no difference, and in other measures there is a bigger difference. And then I started to play with some of the ideas that you've seen done in the literature in other settings of trying to disentangle if there are differences among providers with many low SES patients and those with fewer, whether those seem to be more about the inherent quality of those providers where the low SES patients are going, or whether they seem to be more about inherent patient factors, so you can start to disentangle those things. We have done that a little bit by looking at the results for the high SES patients within places that have high proportions of low SES patients. We have built some models, and this may be starting to get some of the stuff that Sean was saying, where we've tried to put in both a patient and a hospital factor. I'm learning from my statisticians that you can do this poorly and you can do this well, and so we're being a little careful. But then you can start to understand the relative influence of the hospital or the provider compared to the patient. So I'm going to stop there. I just think that it may be useful to try to, as somebody else said, give some examples of ways
in the cases where there's uncertainty, to try and tease some of those things out. And again, I really support Larry's suggestion that in those cases, while we're learning more about this, we try to tease some of those things out, but that we recommend you provide both scores. I think that's a great solution.
Okay, this is Karen. I think good discussion, and I think we probably, again, need to think about moving on for some other topics and come back to more specifics about operationalization. We may have some suggestions that we can circulate and have people respond to that. I think maybe, Kevin, do you want to get back to the specifics about disparities recommendations?
Sure.
Because I think that may also be the key thing we need to address before we reach the end of our time, and we can then see if there's anything else, but I think maybe the specifics about disparities recommendation would be good.
Sure. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to review the appendix that that was attached. It was at the back of the memo, so hopefully people got to it. But it's really an attempt to begin to flush out a bit more on the challenge of identifying and really monitoring disparities and potentially the potential unintended consequences of any actions that are taken as a result of recommendations by our panel. And I put them into three broad broad categories. The first idea was separating out recommendation one and making identifying disparities a separate recommendation from the first part, because it really seemed to get lost in the comments. The second one was to begin to flush out some of the different functions that stratified data can perform and at what level. So the first one is national monitoring, so that I think we would have the opportunity here to begin to actually monitor disparities in these particular measures and then track trends over time. And in that way, look at, for example, the potential that we would have the unintended consequences of actually increasing disparities, or hopefully the opposite, making progress. These data could actually be shared with ARC as part of their national healthcare disparities report, would actually enrich that, because right now they're largely based on existing national and federal survey and other types of data, but these would be relevant to the actual quality measures that are being done. So that would be a substantive improvement in the status quo. And the second one, of course, is quality improvement for providers, specifically related to closing the gap in disparities by making those data readily available. And the third one, and this could be an incremental or down the road approach, is actually making data available to patients like themselves. So one could, if one had a measure that was adjusted, provided information for how a different group performed for a patient of similar race or SES, one would be able to access that, and that's more down the road. And then the third major suggestion, this would have to be an additional recommendation beyond what we already have, which would be to have a standing National Quality Forum Disparities Committee, whose task was really to help move this agenda forward, both in terms of beginning to make recommendations regarding additional measures, as well as monitoring the effect by looking at the data on disparities and making recommendations to the National Quality Forum. So that's the essence of the thoughts there. The first and third actually being would actually mean changes in the recommendations that we have, because it would mean splitting out the first recommendation into two recommendations, and the last one would mean adding an additional recommendation for
astounding National Quality Forum Disparities Committee, whose task was really focused on the disparities issue, including monitoring potential unintended impact.
This is Larry. I like the second and third a lot, and I also, you know, I'm all in favor of stratification and of separating out a recommendation about stratification. But I just want to ask about the status of what we're actually trying to say about stratification in this first recommendation. So it says, for purposes of identifying and reducing disparities, performance measures should be stratified. So I'd like to understand the relationship of that to, if we recommend that there be an adjusted measure or an adjusted measure or an unadjusted measure, whatever we come down on, we spend most of our time today. So then we're saying how we think the measure ought to be. And what's the relation then of saying performance measures should be stratified to that? It's almost like telling them they have to have a whole other kind of performance measure also. And in a way, to me, it's almost like saying how the, so I'll just stop there, but is this supposed to be an additional thing that should be done? Is it an additional performance measure? Is it a modification of the performance measure that we're going to recommend? What's the status of this stratification recommendation?
Well, well, keep in mind, I guess the first point is that it's simply a statement of the way the current draft reads.
Right.
You know, I think the idea would be to have this data available to the public in the same way, perhaps, that adjusted and unadjusted data would be readily available, but that stratified data would be available for the purposes of identifying disparities, because as we've discussed, that simply having adjusted and unadjusted doesn't tell you where the disparities are.
So would the proposal be then that if you're the measure developer, let's just say we agreed on the adjusted and unadjusted. I'm not presuming that, but just for purposes of discussion. So would we be telling the measure developer then, if SES is important, tell us how you calculate an adjusted measure, how you calculate an unadjusted measure, and also tell us how you would basically calculate stratified measures. So would this be a third?
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so it's not optional. It's of the same rank or importance as saying give us an adjusted and an unadjusted measure. Is that the
idea? That's correct.
So, Larry, were you asking what purpose of like having the specification in addition to the three forms of the measure?
I'm sorry, I'm still getting an echo. Could you repeat that, please, David?
I thought Larry was suggesting that maybe we were imposing too much on the developer if we require, on the one hand, show the measure both ways, and then on top of that, have a recommendation that you have to stratify. Do we need
both? Yeah, just to clarify, I wasn't suggesting, I was just asking. I was suggesting the possibility that some people might think it might be too much. I don't have an opinion. I mean, I like the idea of having the stratified available.
I would just support that should not be restricted only to stratification, that other options should be incorporated.
Who is that speaking?
North.
I'm sorry, we're getting some feedback.
It's Norbert Goldsmith.
Okay.
I think Nancy
Garrett, I think you were trying to get in.
Yeah, I was just going to say what I was trying to propose earlier was that instead of requiring that the measure be reported and used both ways, to instead strengthen the disparities recommendation, as Kevin just said, call it as a separate recommendation. We can have some strengthening around having that data available so that we're actually using it. I like the idea of the Standing Disparities Committee, and, you know, maybe we could broaden that to also be looking at this whole risk adjustment question, because as several people have noted, we're just scratching the surface here of these issues, and this format is tough to really get into the depth that we need to. So I think that those things would really help move us along.
And I think this is Karen Pace, just one comment. I think the big issue is, as Kevin said, whether you provide both a clinically adjusted or totally raw data plus the sociodemographically adjusted measure, the score alone doesn't really illuminate anything about disparities. And so if the real issue is about dealing with disparities, then I'm not sure that that proposal is really going to satisfy that. But so I think that's part of what we want you to think about.
Yeah.
Exactly. And just to add, I just want to a nod to Marshall Chin, who's been making this recommendation of a standing video for quite some time. So thank you, Marshall. We put it in the recommendation. We're out there.
This is Gene Ruccio. Currently, when a measure is presented to NQF for endorsement, there is a request that we stratify the results based on a number of different demographic variables so that the review committee can look at how the measure performs across these various demographics. Now, is the question whether that information should be made more public, or is the question that sort of Steve was perhaps suggesting when he wanted to compare likes to likes, that we create new models based on a particular strata or multiple values of a strata stratification for that purpose. I think that creates a major burden for developers. Developers, I don't think, would balk very much about having a clinically adjusted outcome and a clinically and sociodemographically adjusted outcome. That would be relatively easy for them to do, mechanically. The issue of presenting that information simply to the NQF review committee or making it publicly reportable would, I think, is a question that needs to be clarified. So perhaps we could understand, help me understand whether we're asking for new models for each strata or simply stratifying the results that you get from the two approaches that we've been talking about.
Dave here, just a couple of very quick, hopefully semantic clarifications. Steve's suggestion before the break, I would have labeled as in our category of peer group comparisons, and in our in-person meeting we spent some time making sure that we had distinguished stratification on the one hand and peer group comparisons on the other, the former having to do mainly with identifying various sociodemographic groups either within a large data set or within even a single plan or provider, the peer group comparison, the essence being putting like plans and providers together. And we worked a bit in January to try to make sure those were two different things. So I just don't want us to slip back into saying, well, those are two different forms of stratification, because they are quite different. And I guess the other thing, just in reflecting on two or three of the recent comments, stratification, when we talk about use in identifying disparities, can certainly be done at all sorts of different levels by different entities. Individual plans or providers may desire to stratify their own data on a particular measure based on the groups that are meaningful and numerous and prevalent in their own environment. Purchasers may wish to see stratified data across a range of plans and providers according to a set of stratification criteria or variables that they find useful. So I don't know that the issue of stratification is something that falls immediately and heavily on the developers. I had understood our recommendation to be more about the availability of data downstream, so to speak, for a variety of users, for a variety of purposes having to do generally with the issue of disparities, not so much what developers had to bring forward.
Okay, thank you.
So, this is Karen. Let me just clarify. We do ask the developers to do what Jean has said, but that's more at a aggregate level than a individual provider level, which gets at this function three, where you would actually have stratified data available for each provider in a, you know, say a drill down from the one score.
So this is Larry again. So this gets back to what I asked earlier. You know, what exactly we're asking the developers to do. So we could ask the developers to give us an adjusted measure, and how are they going to calculate that? We could ask them to give us an unadjusted measure, how are they going to calculate that? But what are we asking them to do in regard to either stratification or peer group comparison?
This is Karen. I think the question on the table is, it's again in relationship to the masking disparities or masking differences in quality. The proposal that we spent a lot of time on was presenting two scores, and the question is, does that really get at the issue of masking disparities? And the, you know, maybe an alternate proposal is that having the socio-demographic adjusted score in those instances when it really is called for, but allowing, but also having the drill down stratified data available. So it's kind of two ways to look at the issue of making things transparent.
So I understand that as a concept, but I'm just trying to understand exactly what we're proposing to ask the developers to do, and if we're asking them to present that as an alternative to the risk adjusted or not risk adjusted measures, or in addition.
Well,
are we asking to propose how the stratification would be done, or how the data? I don't understand exactly what we're asking them.
Right. So if this were the recommendation that both of these should be done, the socio-demographic adjustment and stratification, then the developer would be asked to
Hello?
Dave, would you continue? We're having kind of an emergency here. Sorry.
David?
Dave, are you still there?
Yeah, sorry. I had to set the phone down a minute and turn away. I don't have a speakerphone. Sorry, I missed the last bit.
I think something happened at NQF, and Karen had to stop moderating.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, I guess I'll pick up the duty. Sorry, I had to set the phone down also for a second, but we're still live, I think, with the rest of us.
So I think Larry's question was, what are we asking developers to do here? And I think as Karen was indicating, there's several possibilities. One could be that we just are fully transparent. You present adjusted, unadjusted data, as well as data that are data stratified, and this could conceivably happen at the provider level. So, like, you get an adjusted and an unadjusted score, you also get data that's been stratified.
Yeah, let me just a question, I guess, to however many of us are still here on the call. I had not interpreted the current second part of our recommendation one about stratification to speak of primarily or even very much at all to developers. I really was thinking about downstream users, or that was what that message was about. It strikes me that when developers are putting their materials together, they are working mainly with national data or with other data, whatever's available at the time,
they may be able to say they can do whatever stratification they want to do with that, but the stratification that they do is not necessarily the same stratification that any individual plan or provider would do. It's not the same stratification that like a regional purchasing collaborative would do. The relevant variables aren't necessarily the same. The relevant levels within a variable aren't necessarily the same. So it seems to me that we're talking about just the general desirability of using stratified data for purposes of attending to disparities, but the specifics of how that's done would be quite variable, quite local, depend on the measure, depend on the setting, depend on all sorts of things, and it just struck me that that was far beyond what we were asking developers for, but I'm just seeing if others had seen that the same way. The point being, if we break it out, make it a separate recommendation, I still don't think that we are speaking very directly or heavily to what developers are supposed to do.
David, this is Nancy Garrett, and that's the way I interpret it as well. So maybe if I offer up an example, that would be helpful. In Minnesota, we have a measure that's called the D5, which is a measure of outpatient diabetes performance, and there are 5 different outcomes that we measure. It's N2S endorsed, actually, and the outcomes have to do with how the patient is actually, how their diabetes is being managed. So it's things like, is your blood sugar at the appropriate level? Is your cholesterol in control? Are you a non-smoker? And so for that measure, right now, we do not do any kind of SES risk adjustments, even though patient characteristics and patient behavior does play in a lot to ability to achieve that measure. So for purposes of public reporting and accountability, it's an unadjusted measure. I did mention that we do have some SES risk adjustments that's kind of buried in the report, and it's not being used at all for the kind of the accountability and the public reporting, but it's there. It's just not very much in the forefront, and it's not used for payments. But my own institution, we are doing a lot of work trying to understand disparities in that measure by race and ethnicity and language. And so we're doing some reporting to understand by clinic how that varies and by measure. So where do we have disparities that we need to address? How can we use that data to help us improve? And so that's really not an issue of measure development or endorsement, but that's where, to me, the stratification is essential in order for us to understand disparities and start to address them.
This is Karen. Sorry for that. We're back. And just to clarify about the developer, I think the way we might think of it is that if there's a measure that the developer finds should be adjusted to social demographic factors based on all of the caveats we've talked about, then obviously they would be in the best position to identify what the stratification categories would be, but they wouldn't be the ones responsible for implementing stratification. That would, again, come with the implementation. So I think the key question is whether there's, you know, we want, I mean, it really is about dealing with this disparities concern, whether the approach is to say we suggest both clinically adjusted and sociodemographically adjusted scores, or whether we really talk about, in the case that there's sociodemographic adjustment, that the stratified data would be available along with that sociodemographic adjusted score.
So, Karen, this is Steve again. When you add some clarity to the stratification recommendation, in that one level of stratification is you begin to compare communities with communities of like characteristics and like perhaps sociodemographics. The other part of this is that the local circumstances are highly germane to patient outcomes in terms of how local communities are resourced. And we talked about this at our face-to-face meeting where a community like, a community like Chapel Hill would be resourced very differently than a resource like a community like the Boot Heel of Missouri, and yet you wouldn't be able to tell that by just looking into the MedPAR data set. So how can we make a recommendation that suggest that stratification has to be, we need to strengthen the data available to really make the strata meaningful in terms of comparisons.
Yeah, and I think as Dave was saying, the what you're referring to is the like comparisons is what we refer to as peer group comparisons. And that does tend to be more in the implementation side than how the measure would be specified. So I think in this case, at the original stratification recommendation and what we're continuing to talk about here had to do with stratification by those factors, which could be at the provider level, it could be at a community level, it could be at a national level. But what you're mentioning is what MedPAC recommended, maybe on a different variable, we've been referring to that as peer group comparisons, and I think where that is in our current recommendations is that for those who are implementing to really consider, even if we do socio-demographic adjustment, you know, they still need to consider other avenues when they're putting these into programs of whether additional approaches are needed on top of that.
So, Karen, this is Larry. We're hearing two different things, and I think it, you probably didn't hear one of them because I think you had to go. I'm glad you guys are safe. I mean, at least some of the committee seems to have the impression that the discussion of stratification or peer group comparison is more along the lines of you might want to do this if you're a provider or a health plan or whoever, and has nothing to do with the developer. And then there other people seem to think that no, the developer ought to say something about stratification. So if it's the latter, I mean then there is the question. If they quote-unquote say something about stratification, are they proposing, or a peer group comparison, are they proposing a measure, and is this a measure that would then be approved or not by NQF just as a proposal to have an adjusted or unadjusted score would be approved or not approved? So these are two quite different things. And I'm not sure, some people seem to be talking about one, some people seem to be talking about the other.
Right, and I guess what I'm saying is I think it will come back to where this panel ultimately lands on what's the best approach to, in addition to the socio-demographic adjusted score, whether additionally the unadjusted score, either totally unadjusted or just clinically adjusted score is also available, or whether the recommendation is it should be a socio-demographic adjusted score plus the stratified results. So I'm kind of seeing them as different options, and depending on the recommendation and what ultimately gets approved by NQF would then lead to what the developer had to do. If the result was it should be stratified in addition to the socio-demographic adjustment, then we would ask the developer to identify what the strata should be, and they would do some analysis that way. So I don't think we should start with what the developer would be required. That will depend on ultimately where we end up with these recommendations.
And Dave here, just in response to Karen, and I don't want to belabor the point, I have been very comfortable all along with the wording of what we have in the report, and I'm happy to see it broken out separately, but I like the wording because it struck me that it allowed, it didn't prescribe, for example, what the strata should be, and it didn't even presume that such standardization could be done, and I guess that's the point I make now. It seems to me that the defining of the strata, how they are cut, which variables, which groups, are very much a local decision. They're application dependent, they're region dependent, they're measure dependent. Well, in fact, they're beyond measure dependent. They're circumstance dependent. I'm thinking, for example, a project we did a number of years ago about disparities in mammography rates in a health plan. We ended up cutting, eventually had 30 different cells, which is a product, I think, of four different stratifying variables. but there's not necessarily a reason to think that anybody else would cut it the same way and choose to do it that way. So it seemed like a general recommendation about the value of stratified data, the positive value of that approach for disparities. That's great. I think that's what we've said. But it, I do wonder a bit about what we could ever require or NQF require of developers about saying what the strata should be. I don't know how they can do that.
I agree with that. I think a discussion of stratification and its value might be very useful, but as a alternate requirement for what the developer has to do, I'm not sure that it could be done well for the reasons that Dave and other people have just given.
Okay.
David Hopkins, was that you?
Well, yeah, I'm disagreeing with what I think it was Dave and Eric was saying.
Okay. All right. And did we ever get with Marshall Chin? Is he still on and want to make any comments in this area? Okay. We need to open the lines for public comment. So I know that this has been an interesting conversation, a lot of good ideas, and we will need to huddle after this to see how to wrap things up with you or proceed further with discussion. But let's first see if there's any public comments. And operator, would you facilitate that, please?
Thank you. At this time, if you have a comment, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. You have a comment from John Shaw.
Okay.
Hi, this is John Shaw from Next Wave up in Albany, and I very much enjoyed the discussion today and think we're very much on the right track, particularly some of the specific recommendations to report the two measures, the adjusted for SES and the clinical-only adjustment. And part of the reason for that is I'm a measure user, and what I care about measures is how can it help achieve better outcomes. And so if there's a variability there, if we see poor outcomes, we need to do something. And what having both of those measures available will help us do is to see where and what is the primary control point. So is it inside and better clinical interventions and better clinical quality, or is it outside, something that's affected by the patient and their informal caregivers in the community and all of the social interventions that are there. We're moving towards getting away from fee-for-service and getting more patient-oriented health and wellness. And so a lot of the controversy back and forth is how we pay for things. And we're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel that would allow payment for both inside and outside social interventions as well through ACOs, health homes. In New York, several of us are involved in implementing the Medicaid waiver to adjust this, and I'm thinking, how might I use the tools to do that? One of the things that might help with visualizing peer grouping, stratification, and addressing the disparities is what I intend to do, if I can get those two measures, is immediately take the ratio. What's the ratio of the SES risk-adjusted measure versus the unadjusted? And that gives me a measure of degree of SES challenge, either plus or minus. Either I have a provider that's serving primarily an affluent, well-educated population, or one that's challenged. And that might give the providers a way to simply find similarly situated peers to compare to by just looking at the values of the ratios. The other thing I wanted to note is, depending on what the measure is, the drivers for SES may be very different depending on the measure. So we're focused in Albany on asthma, COPD, diabetes, and mental health issues. And if I look at what we're doing in terms of designing internal and social interventions, they're very different in those populations. For example, with asthma and COPD, the home and school environments play a big factor where they might not elsewhere. So I think keep going in that direction. Let's get some information out there and additionally give us the opportunity to drill down into the data for whichever of the measures to take it one step further at the local or national level. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Operator, anyone else?
Yes, we do have a comment from Nancy Foster.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Karen. Good afternoon to everybody on the panel, and appreciate this opportunity to listen into your discussions and to comment. As you saw from our comment letter, we were absolutely very much in favor of the recommendations as you originally stated them. Not to say that we wouldn't be in favor of any changes that you might make, but we do believe you have correctly identified an issue that very much needs to be addressed through the NQF process, and that is essentially the NQF's current policy, as we understand it, directs measure developers to essentially not think about a whole series of factors that may influence outcomes, or perhaps other measures, but principally outcomes. And in that sense, it really is very limiting. If my colleague's article and other articles that have recently been written about the readmissions and other measures are correct, there are, in fact, a number of factors that affect the likelihood of readmissions. It's just one of those outcomes, including the quality of the nursing home care that the patient is sent to, the prevalence of primary care physicians in the community, whether or not the patient lives alone. All of these are factors that I think really warrant attention and understanding. And by limiting our ability to call them out in the measurement world, we are really blinding ourselves to the impact of those factors and limiting our ability to address these really underlying causes and drivers of disparities in outcomes. So I very, very much appreciate the comments and the challenges that you've been presented with in trying to outline all of this for the National Quality Forum, and hope that you will continue to strongly favor illuminating our understanding of what are the drivers of disparities in outcome. If it happens to be the quality of care being provided, then we need to know that, and we need to fully understand that. If it's other factors, I think as a country, we need to understand that and begin to effectively address those other factors as well. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Nancy. Operator?
Your next comment comes from Tom Jones.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Tom James with AmeriHealth Caritas. Just a couple of quick comments. We very much appreciate the direction that you are moving. I spoke with the FQHCs in our area, the federally qualified health centers. They're very much looking forward to having these kinds of measures because they feel that they are really trying to provide a higher level of quality than it appears in the standard types of measurement. And by the same token, 2 weeks ago when I was on the cardiovascular work group, we identified several measures that we wish we could couple with the work that you're doing. And then as a final point, I think this is going to, your work that you're considering so carefully is important because so many Medicaid plans as well as Medicare plans use a risk adjustment methodology that is applied using only medical factors. I suspect that with your work, that this will move into the socioeconomic factors that will do further risk adjustments for Medicaid and Medicare going into the future. So please keep up the good work. Thank you.
Okay, and there are no further comments.
Okay, so Dave and Kevin, I wonder if you have any suggestions for how we proceed. One might be to just ask the panel if there are any key issues that we didn't get to that we need to pay special attention to. If you have other thoughts, welcome.
Adavia, that would certainly be one, given that we're just a few minutes away from hard stop. I'd say beyond that, what I think we could commit to doing is to putting out to the group basically a set of proposals based on the discussion today about tweaks, changes, additions, and whether immediately or shortly thereafter go through the same kind of process we went through earlier about support, can live with, don't support, because I think we've got, you know, by my counting, maybe 5, 6, 7 things that we have discussed today. We can't really do show of hands in a phone format, but I think we can move quickly after the call.
Yeah, I think that's a great plan. And if people feel that issues have that they didn't have a chance to raise, please you know, email either us or the entire group if you feel it's warranted.
So we'd like to hear from anyone that thinks that anything in the memo or anything in the comments that didn't get in the memo that you want us to pay special attention to and get back to you on. You know, we, as Dave said, we'll, with Dave and Kevin, we'll get something, a draft put together for you to respond to.
So, Karen, if I hear correctly, the process from here will be to summarize some of the key suggestions made today, get everybody's input, some sort of scoring mechanism, and then take the results of that, and we actually have some consensus, do some kind of modification of the report, and then will there be an opportunity to look at a final report?
Yes, that would be the plan. And I think in terms of just the logistics, obviously the most important thing is to get the recommendations correct. We know that there are suggestions about improving the report and the language in the report, and we will continue to work through those. But I think our first priority is to make sure we have it solid on what the recommendations from this group are that will move forward to the CSAC. But we will definitely, you know, we've already had some thoughts, and obviously we have suggestions on improving the report, and we can continue to do that. But the first priority is the actual recommendations.
Yeah, and that's actually what I meant when I said that. So,
okay.
Is it that the next thing we're going to see is a revised set of recommendations following this discussion, or are there a few key points, if I heard Dave, his thinking, that you would want to poll us on and
yes,
then produce recommendations? So it is still two steps.
Right, it's still two steps.
Yeah. Makes sense.
For your 4 hours of engagement, everybody.
Yes, definitely email us, phone call us as you're thinking of things, because we'd love to hear that. And thank you all so much for devoting this time today on a Friday afternoon, morning and afternoon. So we appreciate that, and we will get back to you as quickly as possible early next week with some things to react to. Okay.
And Dave, one last bit of thought. Again, thank you so much for the way in which all of you have approached this task and the interaction, the commitment, the respect and collegiality. I think this has been a wonderful process of exchange and learning from each other, and it's been really good. With that in mind, let me say I've just valued as a pleasure the level of consensus we've been able to achieve and the kind of common ground we've been able to find. So as we move from here to the finish line, our goal is certainly not to do anything that would move away from the large amount of common ground we have already. I think, at least speaking for myself personally, my focus is going to be on those things we've discussed today that would create an even higher level of consensus than we currently have, rather than things that are going to splinter in some way.
Kevin, any final words? We'll let you sign us off.
No, have a good weekend, everyone. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.